and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack
and Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff during the Oscars.
Yes.
We scheduled this very specifically so we can really easily block that out.
Yeah, well, have you seen anything from it at all yet, Jonathan?
Before I got over here on Twitter, Mahershala Ali won, which is cool. Great dude. Good movie. But I haven't seen anything else.
Okay, because I think seconds or maybe minutes before you got here to record the podcast, I just want you to know that Suicide Squad won the Academy Award for makeup and hairstyling. I just wanted to get that moment on the podcast live. Jonathan has just removed his glasses and has his head literally in his hands. The Academy Award-winning film Suicide Squad.
All right, mini rant. The fact that that movie was nominated for that award was not surprising.
Sure.
It was stupid, but it wasn't surprising. But I thought for sure it wouldn't win. The fact that that movie, and this happens sometimes, where bad movies get a below-the-line Oscar, but like when it goes to Transformers, I actually don't mind, because the effects in those movies are great, and the people who make, clearly good stuff. The makeup and hairstyling in Suicide Squad is awful.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make that clear. The makeup in that movie is bad. It's like, and it's inspired a lot of shitty cosplay, and it basically, again, just looks like a 15-year-old went in and jerked off in a Hot Topic and then made a movie out of it.
Yeah, and then decided that was how they were going to make their Joker.
Yeah, or their Harley Quinn, or their dead. Like, it's awful on that level. There's no way to defend that. That's not one of those below the lines where you're like, I didn't like the movie, but that part of the craftsmanship was good. No, that is one of the most annoying things about that movie. And there's a lot of wins I'm excited for tonight on the Oscars, because I like La La Land. I'm not a hipster who's pretending that movie's bad. It's phenomenal,
sure.
And it's going to deserve a lot of the awards it gets, even though there are other great movies, too. You know, the documentary category is stacked with nothing but greatness. But that, like, nullifies everything else.
Uh-huh.
Especially when you think about, like, there's all this progressive stuff at the Oscars this year. Again, Mahershala Ali just won for Moonlight, which is about a gay black man, growing up in America. You've got all those documentaries like I Am Not Your Negro and 13th and O.J. Made in America. You've got Moonlight up for all these awards. Denzel might win tonight. Viola Davis is going to win tonight. All these great people. And then you give it to Suicide Squad, which, again, is white privilege the movie.
I mean, Jonathan, you need a balance in all things in this world, and sometimes you just need to accept that Suicide Squad is an Academy Award-winning film. Sometimes that just has to be the dark timeline we live in. I'm really glad
I was able
to just derail the podcast
nothing,
with this.
Once Donald Trump has become president, nothing should surprise us anymore, but I still, for some reason, expect there to be baseline humanity in things, and there is not.
Yeah.
I don't know why. All right. Let's get back on track.
Now that we've gotten that out of the way.
And let's do the intro to the show. We're going to talk about a lot of different stuff. This is going to be a fun show. We were off last week because I was busy, and I was also working on some things, frankly, for this episode that I thought it would be a better episode if we waited to record it.
Yeah.
And I know you've been doing other things, too. So we waited, and we're gonna be doing a sprint from here to, like, the summer in terms of things coming out to talk about.
Yeah.
So I think the week off was probably good for both of us. But we're going to talk about a lot of fun, just the different little stuff things. I have a fun story to share and some other things. We're going to talk about a couple pieces of news that are interesting, including all the Nintendo Switch news that has come out in the last week.
Yeah, the embargo just lifted up a couple of days ago.
Yeah, so we've learned a lot about the console, and we've learned a lot about what we don't know, too.
Yeah.
I'm still getting the console, so I will have, my own coverage of that next week, and that'll be awesome to talk about that. But then for our main topics, we're going to do a mini retrospective of The Legend of Zelda in advance of Breath of the Wild.
Yes.
I have played in to completion 3 Legend of Zelda games since our last podcast.
That's so much Zelda.
It's so good. It's so good. I'm addicted. Like, I have a revelation to talk about
with
my love of this series. But anyway, yeah, we have a lot to talk about there. And then we're going to do a silly countdown where a couple months ago I made a countdown of all the Nintendo consoles because I thought it would be a funny topic. And then I forgot to share it, but I have it. And this is like the last moment, before the Switch comes out, so why not now?
I mean, this is a moment where I don't think this will happen, but it is the actual possibility that this will be the last, like, home Nintendo console. So, this very quite literally could be the last moment where you can make this list.
Okay, so let's do that. But before we get into all our stuff, sad piece of news, even sadder than Suicide Squad winning Best Makeup at the Oscars, is beloved character actor Bill Paxton passed away earlier today at the age of 61. Huge surprise.
Yeah.
Very sad. Bill Paxton, we talked about William Hurt a couple of episodes ago.
John Hurt.
John Hurt. William Hurt is a very different actor and still alive.
Yeah.
Sorry, John Hurt a couple of episodes ago, and how he was, you know, we loved John Hurt because he was so reliably good in everything he was in. Bill Paxton is the same way, but in a very different sense, because he very different kinds of movies he starred in. But Bill Paxton is just one of those character actor, American character actors, where when he showed up in a movie, you were like, he's going to be good in this, and I'm going to enjoy his work, and he's reliably going to throw himself into that. And of course, you know, then on top of all that, you just look around on the internet today and so many stories of him, clearly a really just nice person.
Yeah, that was the thing I had never really known about, because, like, you know, I've just never followed him as a person much outside of his acting roles. And it was like, I feel like all of today, every time I've looked at the internet, I've seen another story about him just being a really cool guy. And that's always, that's like the part where it hits you the hardest, is remembering, like, oh yeah, this is like, this wasn't just an actor, like, this was a person, and he seemed like he was a really good person.
Yeah. You know, and I think Bill Paxton was in a lot of great movies and did a lot of great performances, and you can, there's, everyone had a different answer for what their favorite Bill Paxton movie was today.
Yeah.
But something I also think is notable about him is that I remember him from some, frankly, bad movies, too, like Twister, which I don't think is a good movie. But I think it's a sign of how good and committed an actor he was that he makes movies like that, to me, watchable. Because he's really good, even in the kinds of movies I don't like, personally, all that much. And I think that's another notable thing about him, that, you know, his, like, work range was so large, from, like, sort of smaller indie kind of things where he was phenomenal in, to these big blockbusters that, like, he might have done in the 90s or something, that he was also really great in, even if the movie itself is not my favorite thing.
Yeah.
And that's a really unique career, I think.
And yeah, like, and for me, like, just Bill Paxton, there's something about his roles in movies like Terminator and Aliens and Commando and all that, like, Twister, Titanic. It's like, I feel like there's a certain kind of, like, sort of mainstream American Hollywood movie that, like, he was just in all the key one of those in the 80s and 90s, in a way that you look at his, like, filmography and you're like, holy fucking shit. Like, he was in so many iconic movies in ways that, like, some that I didn't even remember he was in.
Well, and you know what, one role people brought up that I'd forgotten he was in was Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's why that movie feels like one of those great 80s, 90s sci-fis to me, is probably more than anything else the presence of Bill Paxton.
Uh-huh.
And that is one of his funniest performances. He is so just on point in that one.
Yeah.
As kind of, not even like the antagonist, but this sort of, you know, douchebag adversary for Tom Cruise. And he so makes those parts of the movie work. And you're right. I mean, he so influenced kind of that era of cinema that when you do kind of a throwback to that, like Edge of Tomorrow, you have to put him in there.
Yeah, you either have to have him in there or someone who can be a Bill Paxton for you as best as they can.
Yeah. So, it's, people need to stop dying. This is just fucking sad.
I mean, I've got some bad news for you about life, Jonathan.
I know.
All the people are going to be dying.
But, you know, in the last year we've had a lot of these too, where it's 61. That's what's, you know, he had so many years left of being that guy who shows up in everything and is really good.
Yeah.
You know? It's, because it is, you know, we've talked about this before, it is different when it's a John Hurt who is much older, and it's not like it's less, it's a different kind of sad.
Yeah, it's a fulfillment of a life of, like, someone, like, living a whole life and just, and passing away peacefully in a very natural way at the end of their life. And yeah, like, someone dying in their 60s, like, that's too young, you know?
So, you know, cool dude, great career. And, you know, if you watch American movies in the future, as we all will, he's going to be, not like new ones now, sadly, but it's just, you're going to see Bill Paxton in so many movies still, and he's got that body of work that he's just a part of that landscape forever.
Yeah, I feel like if you just, like, turn on, like, a random TV channel that talks about old movies, of which there are hundreds, like, you will inevitably see a clip of him, like, every probably 5 minutes. Because he's just, it's just, somehow, I don't know if he just knew how to pick a script, I don't know what it was, he managed to be a, like, key role in so many, like, classic, kind of cultish movies from that era. It's really unbelievable.
Yeah, and, you know, I noted at the beginning, like, some bad movies that I thought he was in, but really good in. But the average quality of the movies he was in is very high.
Yeah.
And he's not like a Nicolas Cage who's ubiquitous but in shit.
Uh-huh.
He's ubiquitous in generally good and successful movies. Not all to my taste. But, you know, that kind of ubiquitous is very different. And, you know, he has this strange, wonderful cult around him and always has, like, I remember hearing a couple years ago about, like, the Bill Paxton pinball machine someone made of all, had a bunch of his roles in there and just people, you know, he was never a guy who, like, stole the limelight for himself or anything, but he built this following just by being a really good actor, and that's something I respect so immensely.
Yeah. No, so it's sad.
Very sad. Bill Paxton, rest in peace. We miss you.
Yeah, and if I can make a really bad, tasteless joke, the condolences also out to Bill Pullman, because everyone just assumes he's dead now, too.
I was wondering which one of us was going to finally make the... Yeah.
Everyone's made that joke. It's a joke one has to make. It's
But now it's sad.
Now it's really sad that, like, no one can ever keep Bill Paxton and Bill Pullman's names, like, straight with the person. They always get jumbled together. It's like, you know Bill Paxton and Bill Pullman, but for whatever reason, you always just mix their names up. Yeah. Maybe now that won't happen anymore for a very sad reason.
All right. Let's move on to some stuff.
Okay, yeah.
I want to kick off with two pieces of stuff related to my brother.
Okay.
One that's relevant to this show, and one that's related to this show, but I think our listeners and you are going to enjoy.
Okay. I enjoy the Thomas checkup story.
Let's start with the down-to-earth one, which is I finally convinced Thomas to play... Well, he also took the initiative, obviously, to play Persona 3.
Yes.
And I was so happy he played a Persona game. And, like, Persona 3 was just easier for him to play because he could emulate it, the PS2 version, whereas if you're playing Persona 4, you want to play Golden, need a Vita, those sorts of things.
Whole thing.
Yeah, and I actually have given him my old Vita, but he would have to find a charger for it and stuff, so it's a different kind of thing. But he's been playing Persona 3, took him about 2 months to get through it, a long game. He actually took longer with it than I certainly did my first playthrough, because his run was about 100 hours. And I know it's because he got really into the dungeon stuff and grinding all the way to level 99.
Okay, yeah.
And I love that, because it's like, that's just such validation. It's like, yeah, that is a great battle system.
Uh-huh.
And yes, Thomas, you're right. Mitsuru does make awful decisions in battle sometimes.
Yeah, you know,
but
like...
you love her for it.
You don't usually want her to cast Martin Karn on something, but she sure likes to.
Yep, we were just joking about that last night. But anyway, he finally beat Persona 3 last night. I've kind of been checking in with him along the way at different, you know, waypoints. And I've been doing it of like, you're at the end of the first movie now. And he's like, how many movies are there? Four? I'm like, oh my god, I'm only at the end of the first movie? Like that kind of thing. And then I had to tell him, like, when he got through the second movie, he's like, I can't be only halfway through. I'm like, you're not. The last two movies are actually less of the game. But still, it's just kind of a fun metric to use.
Yeah.
But anyway, finally finished the game last night. And it was so interesting because... You know, you had the experience where you played the Persona games first, and then I played them, and so kind of I talked to you about it, and that's documented on an episode of this podcast.
Yeah.
But then, like, last night, now I'm the person who converted someone to Persona.
Yeah, the viral infection has now spread to your family.
But, like, you have to debrief after Persona 3. Uh-huh. I'm not going to get into spoilers here, but very heavy ending, amazing ending, and we just kind of sat and talked over Xbox Live for, like, an hour about that, and then played some Halo and talked more about that and other things, and it was just... It's a fascinating experience, I think, that game. You know, that seeing another person I know play that and be able to talk with them about it reinforces to me what I love about that game.
Uh-huh.
And it's also fun just because, you know, you and I don't know a lot of other people who've played Persona.
Yeah, no, it's a select group, for sure.
So it's just fun that, you know, I have another person to talk about that now. I hope the next time Thomas is one day on the podcast, we can talk to him about that, because it's a fun thing to talk about. But it was just interesting and just, you know, breaking that down. And he had a very, I think, similar reaction to you and to me with the end of that, which is that it's emotionally very, very heavy. It's a ringer.
It hits you like a fucking freight train, for sure.
It hits you like a fucking freight train, and there's so much to work through. And they're interesting things like, you know, you and I have always talked about, we have slightly different interpretations of the last scene of that game that are complementary in interesting ways.
Yeah.
And he had another, you know, take on all that, and, you know, like... As much as you and I see Aegis as the linchpin of that game, and she is thematically, the character Thomas connected to the hardest throughout that game was Yukari.
Sure,
and I totally get that, and it was really interesting. Like, one of the things he said was to me, and I guess minor spoilers for the tone of the ending, but just saying, man, I hope Yukari has a nice life in the future. And I get it, though. Like, that's a crazy thing to say about any other game, but when you finish a game like Persona, and it is that decoupling of yourself from this 100-hour-long experience, you are connected to those characters in a way where you kind of want to think about what kind of futures they're going to have, you know? And Persona 3 is very precise in the moment it ends. It is not a meandering ending like Persona 4, which sort of goes on and on and on and on, especially in the Golden version. It ends very precisely and leaves you to fill in certain blanks. And, you know, it was really fun to be able to talk to him about all that and, you know, see someone else complete this game and you know, just be more sure in my convictions that this PS2 game from 2006 has not aged and has all this power to it. Yeah. And it's totally true, I think.
Yeah. And you can tell Thomas, because I've played Persona 4 Arena 2, that Yukari grows up to be the Pink Power Ranger, so she does get a good life.
Okay, he was asking me about this, and I did not know with Yukari in specific. Like, I know Junpei plays baseball, right?
Yes, yeah.
And
I
know
like he teaches like kids baseball.
Okay, and I knew Mitsuru and Akihiko and Aigis become Shadow Hunters.
Yeah.
What is Yukari's story in Arena
2? Like, she goes on to become a college student, and, like, as a part-time job, she started working as a model and then ended up getting a job as, like, basically on the Neo Power Feather Rangers show or whatever.
Featherman R.
Working as the Pink Ranger when, like, the costume is on. So she's basically a stunt woman because she's also, like, the character uses a bow. So,
yeah.
Obviously, all those shadow hunting skills come into use in your adult life, apparently.
That's perfect. That's a great story for
her. It's really good. Her costume in that game is fantastic.
Awesome. Yeah. So, you know, Thomas finished this just in the nick of time because, you know, we're both going to be playing Zelda Breath of the Wild next week. And I think he also wanted to get through at least one Persona game before 5 comes out because he's interested in playing that at some point.
Yeah.
And now, here's the best thing is that now I can tell Thomas to go watch the Persona 5 trailer, and he'll see why it's awesome without thinking I'm crazy. Because if you know nothing about Persona, Persona 5 looks like the work of a lunatic.
Yes.
If you know enough about Persona, it still looks like the work of a lunatic.
It looks like the work of a mad genius.
Yes, that's what it looks like. So I'm glad I can have that conversation, and I don't sound... Like, when I say social links, I don't sound crazy to this person. So... Yes, but anyway, another story with Thomas I want to tell is he is in this, he's in his last year of college. He's doing this class to like fill out final credits, you know?
Yes, about, we've all been there.
About TV.
Okay.
And it's led him to watch some great shows. Like, he finally got around to watching Friday Night Lights and Breaking Bad, so that's been fun.
Yeah.
So, like, I've been playing a bunch of Zelda games. He's been playing Persona and watching my favorite TV shows. So it's a good, like, exchange here. But this is an online class. Which means you get the wonderful thing where you get to see the other responses people are posting to things.
Oh, okay.
So he texted me this yesterday. I'm obviously not going to say the person's name.
Yeah.
But I said, Thomas, please let me read this on the podcast. And he said yes. And he said, I can get you more if you want. And I said, do it, but there's no way there's anything better than this. So I present to you a really stupid question from the teacher, followed by the worst response I've ever seen to anything in a college class.
Okay.
You ready for this?
I am extraordinarily excited for this.
Okay. The question. Many critics have noted that television is becoming as cinematic as film. Do you agree with that? Do you have some specific examples from beyond this class to support your point? And do you think being cinematic is good or even necessary for television?
Okay.
And so that's the question. Dumb question. That's a great question from the year 2005.
Yeah.
But it's 2017, and we all kind of recognize TV is its own thing now, and it's frankly better than film. There's the movie that's probably going to win Best Documentary tonight is an 8-hour TV show at the Oscars. So, you know, this is how it goes. Anyway, here's the response from a person, not going to specify gender or anything. As someone who watches Netflix like it is his or her job, I completely agree that television is becoming as cinematic as film. You aren't seeing shows that are 30 minutes long anymore. You are seeing these hour-long shows that are small movies that are able to put a lot of information in them, such as Scandal. Scandal is one of those shows that has so much information and show you so much in one episode. There are a bunch of shows that show you a lot in one episode, such as FNL, Game of Thrones, and Dexter. These old TV shows, such as The Office or Family Guy, are only 30 minutes long, and you really are not seeing shows like this anymore.
We're so old, Jonathan. We're old now. We're old now. The Office is an old TV show. The Office is an old TV show.
Apparently TV only used to be 30 minutes long. The hour-long thing is new. I didn't know that.
That's all fucking obviously stupid. I just had this moment where I was like, to someone who's in college right now, maybe The Office does seem like an old fucking TV show.
Yeah, I remember watching The Office in college with my roommates. So, okay, second paragraph.
Yeah.
I honestly believe that cinematic is very necessary for television because I believe it keeps people more interested in the show and people already want to watch the next episode.
Bold use of the adjective.
You are able to watch a lot more and see what is going on without trying to figure everything out. These type of shows you keep you on your toes and wanting more. As an example, you see shows such as Scandal or Game of Thrones, you are just wanting more and more and cannot wait for the next episode. I believe certain television broadcasts these shows to keep people watching their, T-H-E-R-E, shows. This relates to the millennial because we are people who are always wanting more and better. So this is one way certain broadcasts are able to keep customers.
What the fuck did you just say? I couldn't even keep up after the person said, like, the television broadcast the show. That was where it killed me.
I didn't know Donald Trump was taking this class.
Yeah, no, come on. Donald Trump would give a much worse answer to this question.
But, like, that sentence where he says, the cinematic is so important, that is completely
The cinematic and the cyber are both very important for the television to broadcast.
Oh, my God. That's beautiful.
Yeah. If you're taking an online class, spell check.
Yeah.
Just spell check. Right, like, if the whatever online service your school uses does not have a built-in spell check system, write your thing in a program that does have a built-in spell check system, and then cut and paste it into whatever custom site your fucking school has. Because there is no reason why your thing for your online class should have that many fucking mistakes in it. If you were writing that by hand, there's no reason it should have that many mistakes in it, but at least it would be marginally understandable.
Oh my God, like, I just found it hilarious. Like, my brother sent this to me and I'm just sitting in my office laughing at it. But he was like, why do I have to work hard? He just had this existential moment of like, why do I have to put any effort into things? And I've totally had that moment in college. I don't think I ever had that moment that hard.
Yeah, no, that's pretty rough, you know, like the closest I've had is in like in a, but this is a totally different way of reading something that felt like that, was when there was a person in my class for whom English was a second language. So it's like, that's really excusable. Totally. That makes sense to me. Why, like, this Chinese person who's like learning English while they're attending school here, like, yes, it's going to be hard for you to write something in fluent English. I can totally understand that.
And just before you think we're making fun of someone with a foreign language, the person's name, whoever they are, it's an American. It's like, yeah. Not a, you know, it's a normal, like, something Smith or something.
No, I mean, so. Because that just, like, yeah, that's... It also just, like, it felt so much like this person has never seen any TV show outside of what was shown in this class. And so it's, like, trying to make some sort of argument about old versus new TV shows is you've already stepped on a fucking landmine because you've never seen a TV show that's older than, like, the year 2010.
I love that what makes TV cinematic is that it's longer has cliffhangers.
Which is also, like, it isn't longer, and there have been cliffhangers forever. So, yes. Like, those points are already wrong. But it's, like, it's wrong both in the sense of those things are not new. It's also wrong in the sense of those things have nothing to do with what makes it cinematic.
And it's, like, the fun... I mean, you're watching Twin Peaks right now.
Yeah.
Which you might talk about in a little bit. But it's, like, you want to talk about cinema in TV.
Yeah.
Maybe go to the moment when, like, TV's prime auteur at the moment came to TV. Yeah. Talk about, like, that. I don't know why that's not in this class. Like, this class also is, like, sounds like it's really shitty from everything Thomas has told me. Because not only are they only using Netflix, but only, like, shows from this decade. Which is, I don't know. And they're watching, like, Scandal and The Walking Dead. And it's, like, no. There are... Anyway... We were in peak TV and you're watching Scandal and The Walking Dead. What are you doing? Anyway, but I thought you guys would enjoy that.
Yeah, man.
So what stuff do you have going on, Sean?
Just like a lot of little stuff. You know, Horizon Zero Dawn is coming out in a couple of days from when we're recording this. Because we're recording this on Sunday. It comes out on Tuesday and I'm getting that. So I haven't really picked up any game to play since the last podcast. Just sort of seriously. I did play some Hitman, and I got Silent Assassin on the elusive target that's up right now, which means I now have unlocked, like, the winter coat and all that shit, so I have gotten all the unlocks in Hitman one can get from doing elusive target stuff, and that felt really good, and just, that game continues to be really, really awesome. I have been watching a lot of TV show stuff, so I've been watching Twin Peaks. I'm almost done with season two of Twin Peaks. It's pretty rough for a lot of places. That is not anything new, but I'm really excited to finish that so we can do our Twin Peaks episode.
But let me really quickly...
When it comes around time to do that.
The conventional wisdom that I hate is that the show was good in its first season and not in the second. That is false.
Yeah.
It falls apart midway through the second. I'm correct, right?
Yeah, I think it... I still think, like, the first season is stronger than even, like, the first half of season two. Like, there's a lot of really good stuff in the first half of season two. But you can see, even before they finish the Laura Palmer stuff, you can see the show starting to get away from itself a little bit. But it is, like,
But there's also great stuff.
No, there's great stuff. And there's, because there's the David Lynch episode before they cast Laura Palmer as the killer, where it's just basically the episode where they like fully like kind of reveal who the killer is for sure. Like, you, I think most people have probably suspected who it probably is by that point, but they like, David Lynch directs the episode where that like gets thrown out there. Like, that's one of the best episodes of that whole show.
It would, even if you put that on today, I don't know if you could get that on network TV.
Uh-huh. Scene at the end of that episode is, yeah, really frightening. So yeah, like, there's really great stuff in season two, but it's less consistent than season one was. I mean, season one is also 8 episodes, so it's like a lot easier for it to be consistent. But yeah, no, like it's still, and even when it gets like kind of off the rails, it is not a terrible show by any stretch of the imagination. It's just like some subplots become pretty intolerable. But even then, sometimes they're really bad. But when Twin Peaks is bad, it's still kind of just fun to watch, because I think the actors have so much fun playing their characters, and it's just a fun sort of setting to be in. And
the direction is great.
Yeah, the direction is always great. Like, it's still a well-made TV show generally. It's just like, you can tell that on like a top level, the show had lost sense of what it was trying to do, which is like, if you know anything about what happened behind the scenes, like, that is what happened. Like, they did not want to wrap up the Laura Palmer murder as soon as they did. And after they did, it's like the sort of linchpin that was keeping the show together just kind of spiraled out of control. And like, every single facet of the show, of the sort of like trifecta of the murder mystery stuff, the like soap opera stuff, and the magical realism stuff, all that shit just goes spinning away from each other, where before it was like kept in like this really tight, insane harmony, which was so delicate. And it's kind of crazy that that didn't explode before it did. But yeah, but even when it's just like off in its own extreme weird thing, and nothing feels like it has anything to do with each other, it's still fun to watch. I'm enjoying it.
Yep. And we will definitely be doing a full Twin Peaks episode sometime before May.
Yeah. So. I'm really excited to watch the movie, because that's so something I've wanted to watch for a long time. But I just had to watch all of Twin Peaks before I could obviously watch the movie, and that had been daunting to me for a while. I'm glad there was like this time to sort of rewatch what I had seen and then finish it off so I can watch the movie now. So yeah, I've been watching Twin Peaks. I also, earlier today, I normally wouldn't bring this up onto the podcast because I don't bring up the anime stuff I watch that much, because it doesn't seem like there's not that much to talk about. But I did finish today, and I'm still just kind of high off of finishing it because it was so good. I caught up on the most recent season of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Diamond is Unbreakable, which all of these are on Crunchyroll. And I've just had to say, if you have a subscription to Crunchyroll, or even if you don't, and you've have not seen JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is so fucking good, and this most recent season is so fucking good. It's probably the second best season of that show. My favorite is the Battle Tendency arc, but man, Diamond is Unbreakable is really fucking good.
I know in the manga there's like 800 volumes of JoJo.
Yeah.
How's the anime structured?
It's basically a straight adaptation of what the manga does, but what's cool about the manga of JoJo, or like the story of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, is that it's built into these sort of story arcs that are more or less kind of self-contained. Like, they do branch off into each other, like lead off into each other, and there are some characters that carry over, but it's this kind of generational story where the first story arc, Phantom Blood, it takes place in like the 18th century or whatever, and then the second one is like the early 20th century, and so on and so forth. It kind of like jumps up until it gets close to the modern times, which is around where Diamond is Unbreakable is set. But it is just like, it's like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is really hard to try to describe, but it does pace itself really well because it constructs like a set sort of story arc for this sort of cast of characters to go through, and then it just passes the baton off to another generation of characters to sort of do their own story. And the style of the show changes pretty dramatically each time it goes on. So like, Phantom Blood is very much like a kind of like weird melodramatic gothic horror story, and then Battle Tendency, which follows it, is like, it has a lot of body horror stuff, but it starts to introduce a little bit of more sort of shonen action stuff on it on top of that. And then Stardust Crusaders is full on, like, it might as well be like a tournament anime with like the way it's structured, with like fight after fight after fight. And then Diamond is Unbreakable sort of takes that and then puts it in a kind of like pseudo-contemporary Japanese, like, small town setting, and has, like, a murder mystery layered on top of it. So it's, it changes style in a way that, like, keeps it really fresh.
I have to say, Diamond is Unbreakable is the best title that has never been used for a James Bond movie.
It's really good. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's, yeah. Diamond is Unbreakable, like,
I cannot wait for Daniel Craig in Diamond is Unbreakable coming 2018.
Yes. Yeah. It's, yeah. So JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, it's fucking fantastic. I can't recommend it highly enough. I do have to say, like, for people that haven't watched it and are maybe looking to get into it, the first story arc is the weakest, and like, but it's also only like 8 to 9 episodes, so it's like, it's easy to get through. And I think it's still good. It's just, you can tell that the author is sort of, Kishibe is finding himself and sort of finding the tone of the show, which is an insane thing. And then once he gets, like,
It's not uncommon for the best anime in manga.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, if you are trying to watch it and you're not fully into it, I would say at least get a couple of episodes into the second story arc. And if by then it's not grabbing you, I would drop it. But, like, if you get there and you're like me, like, you will be so fucking hooked. And then now I'm really frustrated because now I'm going to have to wait for them to adapt the next story arc and wait for that to finish. Because there's no possible way I could watch that kind of show, like, week by week, because it's just too... It's too amazing. So yeah, I also watched that. And then there's one last thing I want to talk about is there's one video game thing I played a little bit yesterday that I want to talk about. I only played about 30 to 40 minutes of it, but I played some of the Ghost Recon Wildlands, Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Wildlands open beta, which is a
beta time.
Yes, it's Sean Chapman's beta corner. It comes up once again on this podcast. It's been a while.
Theme song.
Yeah, it's been a while since there have been video game betas to play about, but, you know, we're out of the winter, so it's time for network beta tests and stuff to come up. And when I say I only played 30 to 40 minutes of it, that is not to say that there's only 30 to 40 minutes of the beta to be played. I suspect you could probably play that thing for several hours, but you are probably not going to want to, because holy shit is Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Wildlands open beta really fucking bad. And I suspect that means the game will be really bad, because it's not like networking shit it has issues with. It is the worst playing AAA game that I have played in recent memory since, like it's playing it kind of felt like playing a third-person shooter from, like, the Xbox PS2 era. Like, it's so stiff, it's so clumsy, just, like, moving your guy around and aiming your reticle just feels so sticky and gross, and the game just plays like complete ass. Like, the whole thing just plays like ass, and it fucking sucks. And it's unbelievable that Ubisoft, which is a company that makes good games and makes bad games, but tends to make at least competent games, would put out something that is just this fucking atrocious. And luckily for everyone listening to this, the open beta has already ended by the time we're recording this podcast, so you don't have to, even through, like, sheer morbid curiosity, subject yourself to it. Because I cannot stress enough just how, like, on a fundamental basic level, I found that game completely unappealing. Like, nothing about the story seemed good either. Like, it's hard to tell if there's maybe more stuff that happens before where the beta opens up that gives you more context. But there is something very much about the, like, weird, big, tough, gruff, like, bearded American dudes going into Bolivia, which has been taken over, which has been turned into a narco state, taken over by narco terrorists, and we're going to go in there and we're going to kick their narco butts and take all of the cocaine. And, like, there's something about just dropping in as a bunch of bearded white American dudes and shooting a bunch of brown people that's, like, feels kind of gross. It's not quite as politically gross as Tom Clancy's The Division from last year, but it's, like, in that territory of, like, the way you're portraying American militarism is really weird and makes me feel uncomfortable. And it's one of those things that reminds me of, like, one of the reasons why I like the Splinter Cell games is that the Splinter Cell games were always really suspicious and cynical of, like, the American military-industrial complex. And most of those games were you, like, getting betrayed by the American military-industrial complex and trying to fight back against it. And that's why I like Splinter Cell. And this is like, nope, like, you're just going full hog with three of your buddies going down to tropical Bolivia and shooting people up and taking all of the cocaine.
So Splinter Cell is like one of the Tom Clancy's spin-off books he didn't actually write, and this is like an actual Tom Clancy book.
Sure. I've never read any of the Clancy's firsthand
work. My dad was super into Tom Clancy, and so we still have a bookshelf with every Tom Clancy book.
Okay.
And I don't know. I look at the titles, and I kind of feel like I know what Jack Ryan's up to.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's all bad. It also, the game doesn't look very good. It has a real bad issue with popping and just like a lot of foliage popping in right in front of you, and the aliasing on the game is really poor. So it's like all the leaves on trees and stuff just shimmer in that really awkward way, and they're kind of jaggy, and it's just like it becomes really hard to parse out any visual information. And the one thing of like Because by far my biggest issue with it was just playing it felt like complete butt, and that's a really hard thing to sort of try to dissect and explain why this thing just feels really bad to play. But I did stumble upon one very specific thing in the game that illustrates part of, I think, what is a larger concern, but is something so unbelievable this is the way that they designed it. I still can't quite accept that this is how it works. But when I, after I beat like the first mission in the beta or whatever, I tried to escape away on a motorcycle, and I was driving down the road on this motorcycle and escaping. And for those who don't know, like, Wildlands has a very, like, kind of Metal Gear Solid 5 open world action stealth thing. Like, that's sort of what it's going for. And so I was trying to escape on this motorcycle after I killed my target, and I just could not fucking turn the motorcycle. And I was just going insane because I was like, this motorcycle just is not turning. It's unbelievable. And I'm crashing, like, I'm flying off this mountainside. I'm crashing into fences. I'm just going through trees because their way to solve how do we do collision with trees is they're like, well, just pretend that they're ghost trees and you just go right through them. Which is like, that's one way to handle it, I guess, Ghost Recon Wildlands. So I'm just, like, careening down this mountainside, desperately trying to turn this fucking motorcycle, and it just, like, it just barely nudging it. I couldn't figure out what it was until I was just trying to test it. I realized the way it worked on the motorcycle, and I didn't go back to check if this was how it worked on the Jeep, which also controlled really poorly, or the helicopter, which also controlled even more poor, but because after this part of the demo, I basically just, like, quit out of it and deleted it because it was like, this is so fucking bad. But for sure on the motorcycle, the way it works is the left analog stick, which, you know, you push left to go left, you push right to go right. In Ghost Recon Wildlands, it works as a digital input, which is to say that if you think about, like, how a left analog stick is oriented and the way it works as, like, an input device, is that if you're just thinking about how it works on the x-axis, which is, like, left to right, it is you have 0 to 180 degrees of movement. And so between that 0 point and that 180 point, you have, theoretically, an infinite number of, like, different points of input that you can have that gives you that analog control. So it's like you can either push the stick and get, like, 45 degrees or, like, 45.5 degrees or, what, you know, whatever. And that's what makes an analog stick very fluid for that kind of movement and makes it work on a controller. How Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Wildlands, as developed by Ubisoft and all their infinite wisdom, how they decided to handle this is, fuck all those other degrees between 0 and 180. There's only 3 points on that stick that they give a fuck about. There's the 90-degree point, which is your neutral position. There's the 80-degree point, which is you are turning left a little bit. And the 180-degree point, which you are turning right a little bit. And that's fucking it. It's basically like if you got in a car and instead of a steering wheel, you had 3 buttons. One which was to go straight, one which was to go left, and one which was to go right. And then you just figure out how to drive that way. Do you want to turn slightly to the right so you can, like, get onto this overpass? Well, too bad, because you're careening right into the side of a fucking building right now. Or it's like, do you want to do a, like, kind of complete 90-degree turn? Well, too bad, because you're just going to go 45 degrees into this park. Like, the idea that you would design this in such a way that you can't slightly turn the motorcycle by pushing the left analog stick a little bit to the left is so insane to me. That you have to push it all the way in either direction to get it to respond at all. And even if you do, it doesn't respond as much as you need it to. So it's almost impossible to make any turns at speed riding a motorcycle in this game. It's so fucking ridiculous that that's how it's programmed. I can't understand why you would do that way. There's no reason to have it be an analog stick. I might as well have been controlling with the fucking D-pad, because that gives you the same amount of control.
It would probably be easier at that point.
It would be easier at that point, because I wouldn't be, like, operating on this weird delusion that somehow me pushing it somewhat to the left is going to make the motorcycle go somewhat to the left, the way it does in every other fucking video game that you drive vehicles in. It's so ridiculous. It felt like I was playing an emulated version of the game that wasn't registering the analog stick properly. It's insane. So long story short, Tom Clancy's Ghost Recon Wildlands, based on the open beta, is a fucking terrible video game and you shouldn't play it.
Awesome. This has been Sean Chapman's Beta Corner.
Yeah, I look forward to rejoining in a couple of weeks whenever some random other beta drops on my lap.
Sure. All right. Let's go ahead. Some other pieces of stuff from me. the video games I've been playing are all Zelda games, so we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But I did get in this week the new Zelda art book that came out. It's called The Legend of Zelda Art and Artifacts. It's another one that was from Japan that they finally kind of translated and brought over here. It's sort of a sequel to that Hyrule Historia book that came out a few years ago. It's in sort of a similar layout. But this one is just an art book, and it is enormous. It's over 400 pages. It's on, like, heavy art paper, like color paper. So it's one of the heaviest books I own. And it is unbelievably beautiful. Like, I love art books, especially for things like video games and manga and stuff. I just love getting those, and I love perusing them. And, you know, it collects, like, all the promotional art, all the, you know, different pieces of in-game art, even things like, it has sprite galleries for all the pixel art games.
That's cool.
And that's just really neat to see, like, all the positions for Link in A Link to the Past in different sprite configurations. That's all just really cool to see. But it has been so fun to peruse. I by no means have seen all of it, but I cannot recommend that book highly enough if you love the Zelda series, and particularly the art in that series, which is, even at the worst games, is beautiful. It is so worth getting, and it's only like $20 on Amazon, and I legitimately don't know how they're selling it for that little, because it's a super nice book, and it's like, again, the, like, just the quality of the paper is so high and things like that. It's all full color. It's really, really cool. Like, the first 100 pages are basically all the promotional art and things, and looking through those is just wild. Like, some of the art they did back in the day to illustrate, like, for the NES games, which, you know, in the games themselves had very limited artwork and stuff, so they would have, like, in the manuals and on the boxes and stuff, or in Nintendo Power, different pieces of art to kind of suggest that this is a big adventure Link is going on and something like that. Those are really cool to see, all the way up through stuff like The Wind Waker, which just the promotional art for that game was incredible. And even has stuff like all the stained glass drawings from in the game.
Oh, cool.
And all the stuff like, you know, the opening to Wind Waker is that, like, scroll.
Yeah, like, yeah, the scroll, like, storybook kind of thing.
It's got all of that.
I like the opening to that game a lot.
It's fantastic. And you get all of that. So it's just, it's a really, really neat book. Like, for me, that's something I love to have. It might be the best, most comprehensive book of its type I have, because it's every game up through Triforce Heroes, which is the most recent one, which no one liked, but the art is cool, so, you know, fuck it, it's for a good book. And it's even got 7 pages at the end of Breath of the Wild stuff, including one that you have to, like, fold out from the book, and it's the image that you might have seen around. I know it's on the inside of the box for the Switch version of Link kind of climbing up the mountain, and Hyrule is in the background.
Yeah.
So just, that's all really neat. And it's got a long interview in the back with all the artists who did the art for the in the book, kind of reflecting on things. And that's really neat to see. So, you know, definitely if you like this sort of thing, you should support that so we can support books like this.
Yeah.
And again, it's, for what it is, it's really cheap.
Yeah, $20 is like, like, even, like, a much smaller art book, you tend to expect to get at, like, $30 or something, like the Persona ones that I have.
Right. They often go for a lot, for good reason. Like, they're worth it. But this one, I think because it's new, it's, like, $20 to $25 on Amazon. And, you know, I got it in this, like, giant box, and I'm like, and of course I have Amazon Prime, so it's free shipping, but it's like, this had to cost, like, $15 to ship this fucking thing.
Yeah.
Shipping books is not cheap. As you and I both buy a lot of books from Japan, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, cool stuff. I recommend that. Another thing I recommend is, I don't check in with this show often enough, but I want to sometimes because it's so good, and that's Supergirl. Right. And I thought I'd check in this week just really quickly, because this week they did an episode about, and you're going to say his name, Mr.
Mixes Pitlick.
Mr. Mixes Pitlick.
Yeah.
Pitlick. Anyway, maybe I'll just call him Mixie or something. But
sure, yeah.
They did the Mr. Mixie episode, and oh my god, it was so great. And I just love that a piece of filmed DC media has done this character. Now, they didn't do him as, like, a little green imp.
Oh.
Which would, to be fair, would be tough on a TV budget and everything. But the actor who played him, I think, did a really good job getting, like, the spirit of that character across. It very much worked, like, the episode very much worked like a really good Q episode from Star Trek or something. Yeah. Where, you know, he's going around and he can manipulate matter and reality to his own whims. And basically, the whole story is, he wants to marry Kara Zor-El because he's looked at her through the fifth dimension.
Okay.
And it's like, this is the woman I want to marry. So he's trying to get her to fall in love with him. And she, for very good reasons, doesn't want to. And so anyway, it's a good story. It's also like, this is right at the moment in the season where Supergirl and Mon-El are about to get together. And then it's like, Mr. Mixie comes in and it messes it up. But it's a really good episode. There was a lot of other fun stuff going on. It was also their Valentine's Day episode.
Okay,
my favorite thing was it aired exactly a week after Valentine's Day. And you're
just
like,
that's what everyone is like in that Valentine's Day mood, is a week after Valentine's Day.
It's just this thing I love about network TV where sometimes like clearly they thought this was going to be airing a week earlier and something happened. And it doesn't hurt the episode or anything, but you're just like, this was supposed to air last week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But anyway, it's fun. It's a great episode, and I just cannot recommend enough what that show is doing. This episode was just maybe the high point of this season for me in terms of just being so fun and I think embodying the show's ethos of being great character-based storytelling for, you know, a comic book ongoing TV show. You know, I think it's the best since probably, like, in terms of live-action stuff, since the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies, of getting that particular kind of comic book, like maybe Silver Age tone in filmed media, and I love that about it. You know, like The Flash, which is also pretty good and is on the CW, I think has gotten frequently too dark for its own good, and that's not something Supergirl has fallen to at all, and I love that about it. You know, they're still going super hard with the Martian Manhunter stuff. They've also had a story arc this season where Kara's sister Alex has come out as gay and has a girlfriend. And it is legitimately one of the best representations of, like, female sexuality and a person coming out and all these things that I've ever seen on TV. And if you ask a lot of people, that's what they'll say about this season, even if they're not, like, big fans of the show. And they did a big, you know, subplot with that in this last episode. And it's just, it's putting, like, so many other things on TV and in the world of, like, superhero media at the moment kind of to shame for me.
Right.
And especially when you can bring in, and we're just going to do a Mixipitlick, whatever
Mr. Mixis Pitlick
episode. And yet, that's the best thing, is that you get to hear every member of the cast have to say that name. And you can just think in the back of your head, they had to rehearse so hard for that. And of course, like, Supergirl has to say it the most, so Melissa Benoist, they do let her just call him Mixie a couple of times, because it's like, yeah, you can only say it right so many times, probably.
Yeah, I have to imagine at some point the crew's just like, oh, fuck, why are we doing this? Because we have to do, like, 100 takes of every scene, because it's like, and it's not her fault, nobody can fucking say this name right that many times in a row.
And they do do the thing where you have to say his name backwards to get him back to the fifth dimension, and the way they Kara beats him at the end of the episode is fucking ingenious, and I love it. So, it's awesome. It's just a great take on that character. They've done so much great stuff with that show this season, and, you know, I love it so much. And I've been keeping up with The Flash as well, because they're going to be doing the Flash Supergirl crossover musical episode with the Music Meister, and I can't wait for that. And The Flash has been fine. It's been an okay season. There's some really good things about it. There's some less good things about it. It's become increasingly ironic that in every episode, Barry starts the show by saying, I'm Barry Allen, and I'm the fastest man alive, even though the plot of every season of The Flash is that there is a faster speedster, he has to get faster to beat this guy, and there's an extra wrinkle in this season where Kid Flash is a character, and he's training Kid Flash to become faster than him so that Kid Flash can help him with something. So, at this point, Barry is just lying to us in every episode. He is very, very much not the fastest man alive.
Is that just, like, part of, like, the opening theme kind of part of the show? Okay, so it's not, like, a unique monologue he has every time?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. It's, but, like, they change it up enough in terms of, like, the editing and stuff that, like he even says, like, he always has some variation of, and I'm the only one fast enough to stop something. And at this point, it's like, I'm the only fat one fast enough to save Iris, his girlfriend, which that's a whole problem in this show, too. But, like, and again, the whole thing is he's training Kid Flash to save Iris because he can't in, like, there's a whole time travel thing.
Sure, yes, it's
so it's
Flash.
Like, Flash, you literally aren't the only one fast enough because you're training Kid Flash. Anyway, I like that they're doing Kid Flash. That's fun.
Yeah, no, that's...
But, you know, at the current moment, there are three speedsters on the team, and they're fighting a fourth. So, you know, they've gone full Flash at this point.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. It is really insane and heartening to see that the CW TV superhero stuff is just going full hog with what they have, which is like the silly part of the DC universe that DC likes to shy away from and like be like pretend like, no, look, we cut off this dude's arm, it's all dark and grim, and it's like there's no silly fun stuff at all. And it's like, you know, you can have your dark grim stuff sometimes, and that's fine, it can work, but it only really works when it's also balanced by having Mr. Mixis Pitlick. If you don't have Mr. Mixis Pitlick somewhere, I can't accept you. Like, this, it's if you're a TV show or something, or like you have a movie series that's going on this long, he has to show up somewhere, or you're just failing in your job.
Yeah. It's good. Good stuff. So I hope they make that like an annual thing like Star Trek did with Q, because that's just a fun thing to
do. Sure, yeah.
All right. My last piece of stuff.
Okay.
is I just want to complain about the Xbox One for a moment.
Sure.
Because, in there. You know, we're going to talk about the Nintendo Switch a little later and, you know, some of the early reviews that are coming out. And there's still a lot of hand-wringing over things the console might have, might not have, things that are great about it, things that seem more problematic about it. But I just want to remind us that there is a console on the market that is a flaming piece of shit a lot of the time, and it doesn't get enough attention that Microsoft so... And I think a lot of people on that team are working really hard to turn that ship around, but the Xbox One sucks. And I want to talk about that just a little bit. Here are issues I've had over the last 2 weeks.
Okay.
Number one, multiple times I cannot get out of an app. Like, I will be in YouTube, I will hit the Jewel button, which is already difficult because on the newer controllers, the Jewel is, like, for some reason indented, so it's, like, literally hard to press.
Huh.
And, like, getting to it, like, it's just a complete shit shot of if you're actually going to hit it. So anyway, I'll hit it, nothing will happen. I'll hold it down, and I can turn the console off. But actually, from that screen, you can't turn it off, you can only put it to sleep. So that really wouldn't help me. So I can't get out of the app. That's been a thing. Really fun. Apps won't launch sometimes. Like I had an issue for a couple days where I would launch a game. It would say, you can't launch this. I would launch it again. You would just say, you can't launch this. And then I would launch it again and it would launch. I'd be like, okay, that was fun. And I'm just used to these things on Xbox One at this point.
Yeah.
My brother and I mostly use my Xbox to play multiplayer games with my brother online. And it's often hard. Just the party system and stuff doesn't often work. But... this was a new one where we were both online and couldn't see that the other person was online. That was fun. And we both had to hard reboot the console to get us to show up as online.
So, like, for both of you. So, like, you couldn't see Thomas and Thomas couldn't see you.
Like, we said, like, I texted him, like, I'm going to get online. And he texted me, I'm going to get online. And then, like, 5 minutes later, we're like, where are you? That kind of thing. And it's like, I'm online.
What the fuck?
You're online. Yeah, so that's a thing. That's fun. And finally, the Xbox... like, I'm so annoyed by all the stuff I keep hearing about people making their clickbait articles about the Nintendo Switch's hidden costs, which there are legitimate things to complain about, but to me it's no worse than what most consoles have, which is that, you're not just going to be able to pay for the console and play with it. You're going to have to get other things for it. And one of the things that Xbox is so egregious about that no one complains about, but it's a real issue, is that the controllers don't charge out of the box.
Yeah, they take AA batteries.
They take AA batteries. It's the year 2017. So I finally broke down and bought a play and charge kit for my Xbox One. I'd had one for my 360 back in the day, but that doesn't work with this.
Yeah.
And so I finally got it. You know, you get the battery. It's like $30, which is, and it's just bullshit, horse shit, given how everything else works now, but you have to do it.
Yeah.
So I got one, used it in my controllers for a while. I've had it less than a year, and it will not charge. In either Xbox controller I have, and I have an old model and a new model, just you hook it into, I've hooked it into the Xbox, to the PS4, to the Wii U at one point, like everything I have in that entertainment center, it will not charge or hold a charge. And I ran out of like the last AA batteries I had in the drawer, and I don't have any other use for AA batteries.
Yeah.
So every time I play with the Xbox now, I just literally have to wire it in. I have to plug it in with the cord, and that's how I play Xbox. At least it lets you do that. But because the Play and Charge kit like broke after like 6 months of use, and I cannot figure out how to fix it, that's what I'm doing with my Xbox now. And that's fun. So you're 2017 and I'm playing the fucking wired game.
Yeah, like that happened to me with my Xbox 360 Play and Charge kit. The first one I bought, like, it just crapped out on me. Like, even faster, it crapped out on me in, like, 2 months. I was so fucking annoyed. And it is really insane that the Xbox One controller still takes AA batteries. And another small thing about the Xbox One controller that annoys me sometimes is if I'm like with someone and we're watching Netflix or something and that controller turns off, it takes like a fucking minute for that controller to turn on, and it's so fucking annoying. And it's so annoying to like be watching a show and the show is like playing, and then someone's like, oh, hey, can you pause? I'm going to go to the bathroom. And it's like, okay, hold on. Let me grab this controller, turn it on. It's like, it's like, oh, like this convenient part in the show that like we wanted to pause it at so someone could like go take a break or something. It has already passed and, like, a dramatic moment has happened because I'm waiting for the fucking controller to turn it on. Meanwhile, the DualShock 4 controller turns on immediately. It's instant fucking-taneous.
Yes, and the other thing is that the DualShock 4, you can set it so it never turns off. And that's what I do because I don't ever want it off if I'm watching a movie. And it doesn't drain that much power when it's just standby like that.
Yeah.
The Xbox One, you have no options with that. You cannot tell the controller to just stay on, and it turns off after, like, 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the worst.
It's really... it's like, yeah, that stuff and just the general clunkiness of the Xbox One's UI is really perplexing to me. I know that Microsoft they've said that they are like working on a really big UI overhaul that hopefully will fix those issues, but it is...
they've done a big... they've done like seven big UI overhauls.
Like, so like, hopefully that they like that is true and that they're like that is coming down the pipeline and will like gut out a lot of this shit and like fix it. But it is really insane that that UI has been like that, like since launching. In some ways, is like from the, my relatively limited experience, has gotten worse. The more I've used the Xbox One, like it, the more often while I run into these issues, where it's like this app just won't fucking close or it won't start. Like it just like I'm just like sitting here looking at this splash screen for like 3 minutes, literally waiting for this app to start running.
Honestly, I frequently have the smoothest Xbox One experience when I'm playing a backwards compatible game and I'm just using the 360 guide within the emulation.
Yeah.
Because that still works great.
It's, yeah, it's very strange. I don't understand how this has happened.
I don't think the PS4 is perfect by any means. There are certain things they still need to improve with their UI. It's slowed down a little bit too much over time. But I never have those basic reliability problems with the PS4. Like, just... I never have those basic reliability problems with the Wii fucking U.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like, Xbox, they should be able to do better than this, and that console has so many just basic usability issues that, you know, I'm kind of excited that the Nintendo Switch is coming out as a super bare-bones UI, because you know what? It'll fucking work.
Yeah. It definitely, it feels like, as with, like, basically everything with the Xbox One, you can trace it back to that, like, their initial sort of, like, vision for that console, and it seems like their weird... like, three UI, like, kernel thing that they did with, like, oh, it, like, has to do the TV pass-through stuff and all that shit, and, like, the snap mode and the Kinect integration and all of that, like, has really bitten them in the ass in a way that, like, it seems like that UI is so memory-intensive and cumbersome and just takes so long to respond to anything, and the more you use it and the more, like, games and stuff that are on it, the less responsive it becomes. It's like...
I honestly hope the Scorpio is radically different. I hope it's a different console. I want it to be backwards compatible with Xbox One stuff, but otherwise I hope it's a clean break because I think they need to make it.
Just they rip out all that UI shit and just like break out a virgin Xbox 360, take the blades from that, put it in the Scorpio, you're good to go.
It would be better than what we have now.
It might literally actually be. Like those blades were way slower and responsive than anyone remembers, but... maybe it would be better than the Xbox One, what it's got going right now.
I mean, you know, I just think it's a part of the larger conversation to have right now, which is that I think the business model of that we've had for the last couple generations of you have multiple consoles that all play the same games but do slightly different things, I think we're past that, and I don't think that works anymore. I think the PS4 has clearly staked the claim as the default gaming console.
Yeah.
It also clearly has... a lineup of exclusives that Microsoft is never going to catch up to.
Yeah.
And I think the only thing they can do is I think the Scorpio should rethink what a home console is. I think they should go really heavy on their living room kind of PC stuff that they've been kind of integrating with. Basically do what Steam machines never wound up doing. And then I think leave that, the space that the PS4 occupies, don't try to compete with that. Leave that to the PS4. You're not going to win. Just as Nintendo, I think, is smartly not trying to be what those two consoles are. And I think I would like to see in a year or two we're in a space where every console is a radically different thing and is not just, I can play Assassin's Creed on this or this and it's basically the same thing. There's no real reason to have that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I hope that's headed. Because, you know, just, like, I wish I could, you know... I really only play Xbox for multiplayer stuff and sometimes backwards compatible stuff because that is the one thing it has over Sony.
Yeah.
Is they've actually invested in backwards compatibility and that's great. But other than that, like, you know, I often am like, I wish my brother had a PS4.
Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. It's
like, when do I break down and just buy him a fucking PS4 to save myself?
That might be a bit extreme at this juncture. Like,
sure.
But maybe if you wait a year, you could probably get a PS4 Slim for cheap enough that it would maybe almost make sense.
Yeah. So anyway, that's just, I wanted to rant about that for a second.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's
Xbox Live is
an ongoing issue.
Xbox Live is also very unreliable in a lot of ways now. It's just, it's things that I don't see covered enough, that I think we hand-wring a lot over other things in gaming and just take the Xbox for granted, and I think pressure needs to be put on certain elements of it. So, that's all.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some news.
Okay.
First, some gaming news. Mass Effect Andromeda, this week, officially went gold.
They are pressing some goddamn discs.
They are. Barring something truly unprecedented and disastrous, that game is coming out March 21st.
Yes.
Earlier if you have EA access. And, so we have to eat a little bit of crow on that.
I do want to point out that the last podcast, the last time we talked about this, I backed away from our hardline stance that this game was going to get delayed and moved on to a, this game maybe should be delayed, Or maybe it's just, like, unbelievably bad marketing. And I think it's unbelievably bad marketing that they have, like... Yeah, because now, I still am not excited for it. I should be so excited for it. But they've done such a shit job marketing this game that, like, I should be so... I played Mass Effect 1 to completion, like, 5 times. I played Mass Effect 2 to completion, like, 3 times. I've never quite played Mass Effect 3 again because there's too much of an emotional hole in me from the first time I played that game in a good way, not in a bad way, because I really like the ending of Mass Effect 3. So it's like... I should be all on board and, like, super stoked for Mass Effect Andromeda. I even liked Dragon Age Inquisition more than most people. But for whatever reason, they have marketed it so poorly that I just don't give a fuck.
I'm in the same boat. I mean, the Mass Effect trilogy collectively is Inner Circle top 5 all time for me.
Yeah.
Like, unquestionably, it is one of my favorite, if not, period, my favorite modern American game franchise.
Yeah.
You know? And they have marketed it so poorly that, like... You know, Zelda Breath of the Wild, a franchise that I did not, like, grow up with the same way as some people and that I kind of recently became a fan of, I have been massively more excited for that game than I've ever been for Mass Effect Andromeda because they knew how to market that game and it looks really good and I have a sense of what it is. I still, like, there were the journalists had their, like, they got to play 5 hours of it, yeah, and wrote about it a little bit with Mass Effect, and I read some of that, and most of it was, even the journalists were like, this seems cool, I still don't know what the game is.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, it shouldn't be this hard to market a Mass Effect game.
Yeah.
Unless, like, something crazy happens in the first 5 minutes and they literally can't show us anything. And I don't know what that would be, but it's nuts.
It's,
like,
really weird.
I've got it on pre-order. I'm probably going to play it when it comes out. But it's like, it's so, like, now that we know the game's actually coming out, it's definitely a marketing thing.
Yeah, no, yeah. And, like, for me, I haven't even pre-ordered yet. I'll probably end up playing it, but there are enough games coming out, and, like, that have come out already that I want to play, like, Neo, and I haven't yet, that, like, I'm waiting for reviews on Mass Effect Andromeda, like, which is a thing that, like, normally I would just be like, no, like, even if I don't love it, like, I will enjoy it. Like, I have never played a BioWare game that I've hated, like, and I've played BioWare games since Knights of the Old Republic and have gone back and played, like, Baldur's Gate and stuff, but for whatever reason, like... There are a lot of video games coming out right now and coming out in the near future, and I want to play a lot of them, and...
You're right, I mean...
Mass Effect Andromeda will probably be one of them, but I don't know right now.
I mean, you're right, because it's also sandwiched for me between Zelda and Persona 5,
uh-huh,
which will probably be the two biggest games just in terms of stuff to do in them of the year.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know if I'll even have time for it at that juncture, unless, like, it sounds like it's... I will definitely play it at some point. I don't know if I will play it the minute I get it.
Yeah, like, I'm in the same boat. Like, I will definitely play it, but it is, like, either I will play it when it launches, or I will wait until it's, like, $40 on sale somewhere and then play it, like, during the summer or something.
Yeah. But it's a weird situation to be in where, you know, this is a... I mean, for one, just video game companies in general did a shitty job this spring of not piling everything up on top of each other.
Yeah.
Because this is the biggest pileup I think we've ever seen at this juncture in the year.
Uh-huh.
Like, Horizon Zero Dawn, I really want to play... comes out 3 days before the Switch. I don't have time.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to cover that, and I'm going to cover Zelda, and that's just how we're doing that.
Yeah.
But it's like, I want to play all these games, and I'll try to find time over the year, but it's just we're at a crazy point, and Mass Effect is sandwiched between two games I am more interested for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's a weird case. But that's coming out. Also coming out this year, revealed by Target, but not still officially confirmed, Middle-Earth Shadow of War... The generically named sequel to Middle-Earth, yeah, Shadow of Mordor is coming out this year and has box art and everything. As of this recording, at least, there's not been, like, an official release on it.
Yeah, but, like, the details on that, like, the leaked Target thing are, like, I forget, it was, like, August 26th or something. It's like, and they had, like, the gold edition of the game also, like, up for, like, $80 or something. Yeah. It was so specific that it does not seem like it's a, like, weird, like, fake. Certainly not faked or anything like that. So it seems pretty certain, and it's been rumored for a long time that, I mean, since the first one came out, that they were working on a sequel, and I remember there was a lot of talk around last E3 that a lot of journalists were expecting it to be there, and it sounds like maybe, like, what WB is planning on doing is, like, no, like, don't show it at E3, like, wait, or, like, show it at this E3 and just say, like, and it's going to be out in a couple of months, which... That's a good idea. I would much rather have that than, like, be like, oh, and this game is going to come out 2 years from now, and then you get to 2 years later, it's like, now it's going to come out 1 year later because we've delayed it. Like, I like a, like, announce and release cycle that quick. Also, I hope that it is a better game than Shadow of Mordor, which is not a bad game.
I
it's a totally okay game. It is a was a massively overrated game in 2014 when it came out, and I hope that at the very least they put a fucking hard mode in it, because that first game was so unbelievably easy, it just played itself, and it kind of drove me crazy that you couldn't just, like, take it on yourself to be like, well, fuck it, just make it harder if, like, I've played these Batman games to death, and this is just a sloppy version of the Batman combat, let me play it on a harder difficulty the way I can on a Batman game, and they're like, no, you will play the normal difficulty, which is... like, you can just exploit the stealth system of that game and clear every single combat encounter in, like, 3 minutes if you just use the stealth.
Nice. I do own this game on PS4. I kind of forgot, but I got it for, like, $5 max on, like, a PSN sale. And I'm like, I might play some of it at some point. I am curious about getting it. I don't ever necessarily want to play the whole thing, but I want to know a little more about it.
Yeah, like, then, it's okay. Like, yeah. It is definitely not a game, like, I would ever play to completion again. But I have thought occasionally about, like, it might be kind of fun to load it back up and, like, mess around with the Nimbus system and stuff.
And, you know, it's totally possible Shadow of War could be, like, a nice improvement on it in all these areas. And I'd love to have another good Middle-Earth game. But, yeah, so we'll see. I just thought the way this was announced was hilarious.
Yeah, and just, like, the title sounds so much like it should be made up. Like, Shadow of War is such a terrible title for the sequel to Shadow of Mordor.
That's the mobile game companion app to Shadow of Mordor.
Yeah, that's either the mobile game companion app or, like, the weird spin-off novel, like, with the same characters or something.
Right. So, oh well. I mean, why not just call it Middle-Earth something else? Like, I think Middle-Earth is the hook, not Shadow of.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of like the Arkham things at a certain point where, like... They definitely can never make another Batman game, I feel like, and call it Arkham something, because they've really run out of those.
Yeah.
And I think they're trying to do the same thing here with, like, Middle-Earth. It'll be the Shadow of series. But that's even weirder than the Arkham series.
Yeah, so. And it just feels like also calling it Shadow of War, like, it's just so, like, vague and nondescriptive. At least, like, Shadow of Mordor, it's like, okay, yeah, like, that is the specific. Like, we are in Mordor, and there is shadowy shit happening. Like, that's always happening in Mordor, but fine. Like, what the fuck is... Like you said, like, the Shadow of War sounds like it's, like, the companion app that's, like, a weird strategy game or something, not... like, you know, it should be Shadow of Lothlorien or something. I don't know. Like,
Shadow of Hobbiton.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
And you play as a hobbit this time who uses the Batman combat thing. It'd be great.
Yes. No, I think you're playing as the same dude, like the Gondorian captain from the first game, but you go to Hobbiton and you go crazy, or like you're just like, you get super fucking wasted and you're like kind of hallucinating and think that all the hobbits are ringwraiths or something. And so you just massacre all of Hobbiton. Just like, and the final boss is like the Sackville Bagginses or something, and you kill them.
It's like Metroid 2, where you have a counter of how many hobbits there are and you have to murder
kill every single hobbit, and that's how you win.
I'd play that.
Yeah, so would I.
It would be like the ultimate pissing on the grave of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes, yeah. I mean,
they've gone pretty far.
Yeah, Shadow of Mordor was a pretty... They drank deep and they pissed long. But that would be another level, yes.
Yeah. All right, moving on. You wanted to talk about the new Ghost in the Shell trailer?
Yes, so this happened shortly after the last podcast, so it's a little bit old at this point, but they released a second trailer for the live-action Ghost in the Shell movie starring Scarlett Johansson as Motoko Kusanagi. And like, also, like, sort of, like, ancillary to this, me watching this trailer, as of the trend of, like, me watching the first trailer was, it just inspired me to be like, fuck, I should watch more Ghost in the Shell stuff, because I haven't seen any Ghost in the Shell thing since I was in high school. I ended up rewatching all of the Standalone Complex TV show, which is very, very good. For people who haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. But, yeah, this is a movie project I've been pretty skeptical of in general. Like, there's the whitewashing thing, which... like, is an issue, but, like, for, like, the main... but, like, it could be a great movie, and that's, like, neither here nor there. That's kind of an issue outside of, like, what is happening in the movie itself in terms of, like, the plot and all that, obviously. And so it's, like, you know, that does not keep it from being a good movie. But I feel like, while I was sort of skeptical about it, like, the first trailer seemed like, oh, there's, like, a unique visual thing going on here with some of the construction of the world. Like, it looks cool. But it seems like also they're maybe, like, copying a lot of the basic imagery and, like shots are, like, literally, like, shot-to-shot remakes of shots from the animated film and stuff. But this trailer, the second trailer, has a lot of the same stuff from trailer one, but then halfway through it, it hits a point where they start, like, kind of going more heavy on what the plot of this movie seems like it's going to be. And that's where it took a turn from me being, like, skeptical about it to me being, like, this maybe is going to be actually, like, really bad, is it seems like they're going full, like, stereotypical Hollywood, like, oh, you're the, like, the first and only, like, cyborg, like, all cyborg person at Motoko, but, like, oh, we've, like, Section 9 has messed with your memories, and it's like, who am I really? Like, they introduced this whole, like, thing of, like, oh, you once, there's a literal line that's like, you once had a family, Major, don't forget them, and it's like, that's not what goes, that's one that's like literally just not what the Ghost in the Shell is about, but it's also like that is not thematically what Ghost in the Shell is about, is it does not give a shit about like the Major's past and like all that. It's like that's so irrelevant. That's they don't give a fuck. Who cares like what the Major's past is and what her family was like, even in the standalone complex TV show that obviously like because it's a TV show goes more in depth on that stuff than the movies ever did. It's like that's not what this franchise is about, and that's like not what it's good at. Like there's a billion Hollywood movies where you can do the thing of like super assassin lady who's like working for the shadowy government organization and then finds out that she's been manipulated by it. Like that's like the Jason Bourne story or something at some point. And that was really frustrating to me to see like next to their like weird slavish remake of the first movie, and then you transition into this weird section of the trailer where it's like, and now we're going to talk to you about this like cliche Hollywood movie plot. It's like that is completely the opposite direction you should be going on with this movie, and that's really
if that is actually representative of what if the it movie is.
Yeah,
is, which
there's always that caveat of the trailers can very seriously misrepresent films, but it was like, I fucking really hope that's not what that movie is about, because if so, that's going to be a massive bummer. Because I will still maintain that there is a really, really cool, good Ghost in the Shell movie to be made from Hollywood. It's just that's not it. And I also don't think that like remaking shot-for-shot elements of the animated film is it either. Like, I would be much more interested in them doing another story in that universe and with those kinds of themes, but update it kind of for today and stuff. Like, there's so much room in that universe because the universe is so rich. And yeah, I'm just really frustrated by what these trailers have been showing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get it. I will say, the whole, like, experience around the movie also annoys me a little bit in some of the conversation online. The whitewashing thing is a problem.
Yeah.
When it's the kind of thing, though, where when we focus on just this one movie or something, you so miss the forest for the trees, I feel like. The other thing that I saw is, like, as part of this round of marketing, like, Scarlett Johansson did an interview where she was asked about the whitewashing, and she said she felt it was more about gender than race, which, you know, one, she has no perfect answer she can give to that question, yeah. And two, you know, people, I don't think it's a horrible answer either, but the thing is, people got, you know, on Twitter so snarky at Scarlett Johansson, who's a really good actress and seemingly a really good person and stuff, and I don't think does this with malice or anything, and to me it misses the point of, like, one, it is not Scarlett Johansson's fault that whitewashing exists in Hollywood. It is not her fault that this movie is being made the way it is. If she, like, took a moral stance and said, no, I won't be in your movie with whitewashing, they would just get a different white actress. There is no world where Hollywood makes a movie of Ghost in the Shell with Asian American or Asian actors. And that's horrible that that's the case.
Yeah.
But that's just the way the world works. Like, Ridley Scott tried to say this when he made that Exodus movie, and he said it in a super racist way because he did the whole thing about Mohammed so-and-so was quote. Yeah. But what he was trying to say is, the movie wouldn't be funded if I actually hired actors of color. And what he was trying to get at, and again, he said it in a horrible way, and he does deserve criticism for that, but it is true that that is the system Hollywood has. So it's a systemic thing. It is not about one actor or one director or one movie. And I just hope we don't. It's one thing that happens a lot online where people, I think, very much lose the forest for the trees. Like when people still get up in arms about Jimmy Fallon tussling Donald Trump's hair.
Yeah.
Guys, it's not Jimmy Fallon's fault that Donald Trump got elected.
Sure.
Shut the fuck up. Like, you are. That does not help literally anyone when you are still bitching about that. You know, it's that kind of thing that it's like annoys me a little bit in that, yes, media needs to be held accountable, but there's a way to do it, and I think going super granular about it doesn't help anyone.
Yeah.
Especially because that doesn't help with the systemic issue.
Yeah.
Which is that Hollywood thinks there is an issue, like, at the box office that we know is not actually the case because it's a chicken and the egg situation where they don't actually try it, so there's no case for that to happen. But, you know, all I'm trying to say is it's this systemic thing, not just about the movie. I am interested to see what the movie is and how it does. It's got Beat Takeshi in it, so, you know,
that would be cool. Yeah, that is very good casting. Although, like, but the question of, like, of Scarlett Johansson's response to that being, like, it's gender, it's more about gender, not race. Like, one, if she is, if like, assuming the movie is thematically very similar to the animated film, like, that is 100% correct. Like, that movie is all about gender. But it's like, but that's also to the point of like, but this movie should be more about race because it is the American Ghost in the Shell. Like, of course, Japanese Ghost in the Shell is not about race because that is not a big issue in Japan's culture, or like, not like what Japan thinks of itself as being a big issue in this culture, whether or not it is, which like it is to a certain extent, not as much in America, obviously, because it is more of a mono-ethnic culture. But like, Ghost in the Shell doesn't deal with that at all. Like, it just doesn't even approach it, doesn't question it. Like, you just assume all the people in this movie are Japanese because it's set in Japan, and the vast majority of people who live in Japan are Japanese. That is not the case in America, and like, obviously this movie is not set in America, casting aside that, like, but it being made by American companies and like being made by Americans means like you people should like look at this story and be like, well, how does race affect this world? What does the American perspective bring to this franchise? And that's why it frustrates me, because it's like, I don't need to see a live action shot-to-shot remake of the animated film, because that's going to be crap.
Right. And absolutely, you're 100% correct on all of that. And if the movie is actively, you know, hurt thematically and doesn't work as a film in part because it does not address the racial things it brings up,
yeah,
that is the time to have a critical discussion about it. I feel like on a more granular level.
Yeah, but attacking Scarlett Johansson is not the place to do that. You're right about
that's
that.
That's all. Sure. And again, not a perfect response from her at all. Again, it's a systemic problem that she is not the one who created it. So it's like there's a certain point where that's only going to get you so far talking about that.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I wanted to say. So, yeah. It'll be interesting to keep this discussion going. Maybe we'll have to do a Ghost in the Shell episode before.
Sure, I would do that.
I haven't seen as much of it as you have, so that would be hard.
It is very good.
We could at least watch the movie and talk about that. Yeah.
It's a good movie.
We should do that. All right. Let's talk about the Nintendo Switch.
Let's talk about the Nintendo Switch.
I have this on my outline just as Nintendo Switch News Cornucopia, because there was a shit ton of stuff that came out, and I've been following it very closely because I'm really interested in this. And it's been interesting, you know, press got the Nintendo Switch in, and they were allowed to write up some previews and show some stuff. Like with a lot of consoles, there's things they can't talk about yet. This did, not to quite this degree, but there were, you know, PS4 and Xbox One had day one updates that precluded people from talking about them in too much depth before they actually came out. Same with the Switch, they can't go into the eShop yet.
Yeah, there's no network stuff at all. Like, the networking just capabilities are not on until the day one patch servers go up.
Right. So we really don't know how exactly that's going to work. But, you know, and it's interesting because there have been some things about the Nintendo Switch pre-release coverage that are wildly positive, like the build quality of the thing, and that it works exactly as advertised in terms of switching from the console version to the tablet version and things like that. And that when they're working, people tend to really like the Joy-Cons or the Pro Controller or things like that. And the screen quality of the tablet sounds like it's fantastic, which is great.
Yeah.
And that, you know, literally people could not be more over the moon about Zelda Breath of the Wild, which is a really good thing to have for your big launch game.
They're maybe almost like to an obnoxious extent they're over the moon about Breath of the Wild, and that, like, I have literally spent my entire life reading articles about how the new Zelda is the best Zelda ever made, and they've never been right about it, and they might be right this time, but it's like, video game preview writers, you need to put that, like, put that on your shelf and ignore saying that because it means nothing to me anymore. Like, they're like, I am extremely excited about this Zelda game because all the preview stuff is telling me that this is the Zelda game I have wanted since Ocarina of Time, basically.
Me too.
But, like, but there are some areas in which, like, people have been so excessive in their prose that it's like, maybe back it up a second and wait until you actually finish the game before you're like, and this might be the best Zelda ever, because literally, that is how, like, I remember reading articles about Twilight Princess on fucking magazines back in the day about how that was going to be the case, and look where I am now.
Anyway, but yeah, so, you know, but it's also been cool, like, I think the best writers and people out there have been less on that kind of thing and just really are focusing on what they've seen and saying it's really cool for this, for X, Y, and Z. I've seen a lot of good coverage, too.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it sounds like, you know, there are really cool things about it, like, you know, you pop in the Zelda cart and you are playing it immediately. There's, like, no load times, there's no installs, stuff
there's
like
no,
that.
There's no, more to the point, there's no excessive tutorializing at the beginning of the game, which has been the, like,
bane of Zelda
for a while. The bane of Zelda for fucking, like, over a decade at this point.
Yeah, so there's stuff like that. You know, people are just starting to get other games in. It sounds like they sent it to most critics with just Zelda.
Yeah.
Which makes sense to some degree. I don't know why they didn't get 1-2 Switch at the same time.
Exactly,
but the people do have it now, so you're hearing a little bit about that. Although, I wonder how much more there is to hear about 1-2 Switch, because people did play it at all the preview events and stuff. So, but anyway, so getting some of the other games.
I mean, I'm just waiting for the sick Super Bomberman R previews, because that's the game that everyone wants to get on the Switch.
It seems like it's going to be pretty good, but yeah. I don't know.
I've heard things about that game that did not seem super great.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, we'll see. But yeah, so a lot of the coverage is positive. But then there are things that are question marks and negatives.
Yeah.
You know, there was the announcement, there will be no virtual console day one. That, to me, was a significant blow because, you know, I did not expect them to have every virtual console game in their catalog up day one. That would be a ridiculous expectation. But to not have at least a little bit...
not have Super Mario World and Link to the Past is insane. Like, come on, guys.
It's just...
get those two.
It's because for so many reasons, but part of it is just that's such a great way to sell this thing and to your loyal fans and to say, look, you can play Link to the Past on your TV and then bring it with you on the go and things like that. It would be just such a nice way to also like have something in the eShop beyond just the basic launch lineup, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, and on the flip side of that, they did add a couple more games to the launch lineup, including Snipper Clips, which is supposed to be really good from all the pre-release coverage, and it's only $20. It's a $20 download game. And the other one they added is Fast RMX, which is a sequel to a Wii U game that was acclaimed, but I think kind of was under the radar. But it looks like this one is pretty cool, too. It's like an F-Zero spiritual successor.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's like 1080p, 60 frames per second, super fast racing. It looks like a really cool... And again, because it's only $20, it looks like a really cool thing to get for your launch hardware and try that out. So they've beefed up the launch lineup a little bit, which is nice. But again, the lack of virtual console and the continuing lack of any indication whatsoever of what they're doing with it is annoying.
That's to me, that's more the biggest issue of, like, you know, it seemed like there was a good chance that maybe Virtual Console wouldn't be there at first, especially, like, the closer we've gotten, the more it's been clear, like, just how sort of, like, hot this thing is coming in, that it's very obvious that, like, this thing probably should have launched maybe actually this holiday season and had, like, a more robust launch lineup and had, like, the online features and everything. Like, it is definitely coming in super hot. So it's like, hey, it would be, like, obviously, ideally, there would be Virtual Console stuff at launch, but it seemed clear, like, that's a good chance that it's not going to be there. What to me is not acceptable is, like, the way they announce it, which was basically just telling to reporters, there will be no Virtual Console on the Nintendo Switch at launch. We will talk more in a future date. And that's all they had to say. Two fucking sentences. And that's all they've said about the Virtual Console other than, like, their, like, pseudo Games for Gold program. That's all we've ever heard about the Virtual Console on the Nintendo Switch at all.
If they said, there's not going to be there at launch, but in the April window or something, we want to launch with this, you know, X, Y, and Z, I would be fine. That would be totally acceptable to me. If I understand certain things are not there for launch, look, every modern console comes in super hot.
Yeah, I mean, any piece of technology or software, hardware, like, all that shit comes in as early as they think they can get it.
Most of the stuff on the Switch is not out of the ballpark of expectations for a modern console launch.
Yeah.
It isn't. Some of the way they have messaged it, though, is frustrating. Of course they will have Virtual Console at some point. I would, and I think a lot of Nintendo fans would feel a lot better if they told us at least what window they're aiming for.
Yeah.
And they do know what window they're aiming for.
Yes.
Internally. They know that. They can tell us that. You know, and if they slip, at least they can be honest about that, too. That also happens, you know?
And then also, like, I just feel like it should be business 101 for something like this, that when you have to come to the table with bad news, you should have, like, something else to give that's, like, okay, yes, like, Virtual Console will not be available on the Nintendo Switch at launch, but, like you said, like, this is the window in which it will be available, or, like, these are, like, the titles that will be available when it does launch, and, like, here's the cool things that the Virtual Console on the Nintendo Switch can do. Like, or, give us something about, like, hey, like, you will be able to, all of the Virtual Console titles you have purchased on all previous Nintendo platforms you will have available for free. Or, like, the $1 up price, or, like, whatever it is, have something so that people, like, have something to take away with of, like, oh, this is going to be what Virtual Console will be like on the Switch. Not just, like, are they even going to put Virtual Console on the Switch? Why would they say it like that? Are they fucking crazy? What's going on?
And the weirdest thing with this is that they actually do have a bunch of good things they could announce and focus on. Like, people have looked at the user agreements and stuff on this, And it has become clear your purchases are now tied to your account, not the console. That is in the user agreement. And if you upgrade your Nintendo Network ID to the new Nintendo account system that they're making, it's a really cool process. And on the Nintendo, it's like account.nintendo.com. You do that, it has your entire purchase history for the history of your Nintendo Network ID to now, and it's going to go forward, and it's right there so they can look that up. And that probably is how they're going to do it.
Yeah.
So, and even if they didn't want to say that part of it, all that other stuff, like it's tied to your account, not the system, this kind of stuff, that should not be journalists breaking that. That should be Nintendo bragging about that, because that's cool, and that's cool that they're updating that and modernizing that.
Yeah. I mean, actually, how that one was found out was that was from the dude who got his Switch unit early and put up a video online, and then people on, like, NeoGAF forums and stuff, like, looking at the frames and reading the terms and be like, oh, I bet this means that. Like, that wasn't even reporters reporting on it. It was fucking people on forums. Like, that should not that be the job of the fans to fucking figure out what your fucking EULA says. You should be able to say, like, hey, this is what how the account stuff is going to work on our console that is out in, like, 3 days.
Yeah, so it's a weird case where I would say most of the Switch news is good. A lot of it is being messaged poorly, too. Like, you know, so there's that. It's I don't know. It's confusing. Let's move on to a couple other things with it. You know, I'm just trying to decide where to go next, because there's a lot of different things you could talk about. I mean, the other thing that's weird with the UI is that everyone... This is another example of good news that is reported poorly.
Yeah.
Everyone likes the UI on the Switch.
Yes.
They say maybe it's a little bare bones, but it's like the cleanest, fastest UI Nintendo has ever had. It looks like it's very much in the mold of the PS4 UI, which we both approve of, definitely.
It has a black theme with white text, which is very good.
Yep. And it's clearly... It's something they can build on, but it looks like a really good launch day UI.
Yeah.
Why was our first view of that an unboxing video from a guy who got a stolen Switch?
Exactly, yeah.
That is something you want to show off because it's cool.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it is just, it's so nuts that that's how that comes out, because it's like, you know, we, for the Xbox One and the PS4, I think for the Xbox One, they showed the UI at the literal announcement of that console. For the PS4, it was the E3 before it came out. Like, we knew the basics of how a lot of those things on the system looked and worked months ahead of time, because it's in stone months ahead of time, so there's no reason to be, like, weirdly coy about it. Like, just show us what that is, and, like if there's something cool about it, like, say it and put it out there, and then get people excited for it. Don't make people, like, fucking skunk around on forums, like, with their weird things, like, magnifying glasses, like, oh, this is what the EULA says, this is what it means, like, I have to, like, look at some fucking leaked video to be excited about the black theme on your console. Like, put that information out there.
So, you know, it's a weird thing where my fundamental takeaway about a lot of this is that, like, for the UI, let's keep it with that, I'm very excited to use that UI. Looks like a great UI. Like, the way they've tied in accounts and, like, you know, you can have multiple accounts on the system. It all looks super clean and, like, something, like, even cleaner than, like, the Xbox One and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, I really want to use that. The weird thing is, I have to piece that together from, like, ignoring even the unboxing video, just, like, the official, like, journalistic coverage. I have to watch, like, Game Explains video and Polygon's video and Kotaku's coverage and things like that, and kind of piece it together for myself and make my conclusions, and I just don't think that's a super effective marketing strategy.
Yeah.
It's a little weird. So, you know, that's all nice. In terms of issues, it sounds like the biggest issue it's having from a hardware level, and this is concerning mostly because Nintendo has not, on the record, said anything about it, is that the left Joy-Con, it actually does not go out of sync.
No, it has signal strength issues, it seems to be the problem, and that the Bluetooth signal to the console can get interrupted or intercepted in different ways, and thus have a latency issue whereby, like, the example that everyone who's using it, the journalists use, is that you're just, like, running around in Legend of Zelda using, obviously, your left stick, and then whatever happens, whatever makes the issue occur, and this is only when you're playing on the TV, obviously, because if it's cooked up to the Switch console, like, the signal is right there. It's not going to get interrupted by anything. But if you're playing on the couch and playing on your TV, that link is just like you're trying to turn, but the signal is not reaching the console, so it's still reading your input as going forward, even though you're trying to go right, and so Link just keeps on going forward for like half a second or a second, which, like, depending on where that can happen in your game, that could get you killed instantly, you know?
Right.
It's not an issue, you obviously, it's not ideal.
Yeah. So, Game Explain on YouTube did a great video trying to kind of get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And that's the one that's probably the most definitive take on it so far, where the guy basically found something in the settings about a calibration and was able to kind of recreate it in a variety of scenarios. And it's not a desynchronization issue, as you say. It is kind of a signal strength thing where, depending on how you hold it, where your Switch is, things like that, you know, it looks like you could totally set it up so that that wouldn't happen, but it's obviously not ideal, and it's not clear if that can be fixed through firmware. It might be able to. There's a lot of things you can do with those sorts of things now, obviously, and hopefully. And there has been, the one word is Stephen Totilio from, or however you say his name.
Totilo.
From
when you say Totilio, it sounds like a pizza roll brand or something like Tostino's.
Yep. Totilo from Kotaku said, PR from Nintendo told him they're aware and they're investigating. And they probably are working on it and don't have anything to say.
I mean, surely they would have been aware of this before it even got out there. Like, it's been so common. Like, I've seen, the vast majority of game critics I follow on Twitter that have access to the Switch have all reported the issue to, different extents.
Yes. So it's by far the most worrying thing from the pre-release coverage. You know, it's hard to know what to make of it. Hopefully it'll be part of that day one patch that they can fix that a little bit. But it's weird, you know, and it's there were a couple of things combined that on the first couple of days of coverage made me question a little bit whether I should not go through with my pre-order. And, you know, I'm coming to this from a couple different vantage points. One is that, you know, I am hosting a podcast where I want to cover it, and I feel like if I'm going to play Zelda no matter what, I want to cover the Switch no matter what, I should just get it. I'm going to want this thing later. And that's kind of where I've gone to. I'm definitely keeping my pre-order has, it looks like it's not going to get canceled. Best Buy charged everything. It's getting ready today, so that's nice.
But they could switch it out on you at any second, John.
They very much could. But I was wondering, should I play Zelda on Wii U instead? But here's where the next issue comes in with the pre-release coverage. And this is more common industry stuff, but it annoys me a little bit, is that, you know, we've had everyone's playing Zelda on Switch journalists, so we've gotten a good sense that it sounds like it's running very smoothly.
Yeah.
A couple of frame rate dips here, but nothing that's not to be expected of a game of that size in this day and age. You know, it sounds like they really have ironed out any flaws that were there in some of the other demos. So that's great. Sounds like it looks great, runs great, awesome. No one has played the Wii U version since E3.
They have not sent out the Wii U Switch version, as far as I can determine, to anyone for preview purposes or review purposes.
Right. So I don't think we're going to know anything about how that version of the game runs until launch day.
Yeah.
Now, would I expect there to be big problems with that? No, Nintendo's, you know, quality control is the best in the business for that kind of thing. I would be surprised if there's anything significant with that. But it does make me wonder, it's just worrisome, you know? Because it's like that choice. And again, that is much more, I feel, industry standard. Obviously, if you have a game launching with a new console, you want to show the new console thing. Everybody would do that.
Yeah.
But it is still annoying.
It's obviously, it's a different kind of thing, but it is kind of like when, the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One launched. Nobody's going, reviewing the Xbox 360 version of Destiny or Shadow of Mordor, you know?
Right. So, you know, that part's a little annoying, but it's just, there were a lot of, the number of unanswered questions are still obnoxious, especially because it seems like most of the stuff Nintendo has to share with us is good.
Yeah.
So, why hold back on so many things? Like, I'm sure their virtual console plans, once they're ready to show them, are gonna be cool. Share a little bit of that.
Yeah.
You know? If you have, you know, online stuff that seems like it's going to be cool, tell us about it. I understand why it's not on the system yet. That is a common thing to wait to launch that until launch day.
Whatever. Oh, yeah. But, I'm not expecting that for the preview part, no.
Right. But I'd like to hear about it. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, we should know basically what it is and, how it works from, an abstract perspective at the very least.
Like, is that smartphone app launching on March 3rd? Are we supposed to use that on March... Now,
I have no idea.
The launch does not have a lot of online games. You know, Zelda does not have any online functionality for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
So, you know, it might not be all that much of a concern right at launch. But, you know, by the time, Mario Kart 8 comes out, that's going to be one of the first... That's in April.
Yeah.
That'll all have to be up and running by then. So there's just confusing things. And, you know, overall, I'm very excited to use this console. It is, in so many ways, the console I've always wanted. It's got this great game I can't wait to play in Zelda. Yeah. There's little things that a lot of people haven't even focused on, but that I've seen that's so awesome, is that because it's a tablet and it's sort of a mobile device at its heart, it goes on and off from sleep instantly. So even if you've got it in the dock, you can just basically press the button on the controller, it wakes up, and you're playing Zelda in less than 10 seconds. Even the PS4, Xbox One, which have Suspend Resume, which I love, you're never getting into a game that fast. So that's a really neat thing about this, and that you can, you know, just the basic concept of the console clearly working so well, that's great, but I want to know more, you know?
Yeah.
And I know Nintendo's in the position where they've sold out every single pre-order and all that, that's great, but it doesn't hurt them to tell us these things.
Yeah, it's it's just been kind of like the marketing for the Switch the whole time has been this weird two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. It just feels like there's no reason for it to be like that. And it's I still kind of can't believe that the way we all saw the UI for the first time was through a leaked video from a stolen version of the console.
Yeah, it's weird. You know, because some parts of their marketing for the Switch have been fantastic. Like, I think the core of their commercials and stuff,
yeah,
that's the best Nintendo's pitched something since the Wii came out. You know, in terms of they have a clear idea of what they want people to get out of this, and that's cool. But then a lot of the peripherals, but the stuff around the periphery is a lot harder to get a gauge on.
Yeah.
And that's bizarre to me. And, you know, I'm very excited to get... I've taken off work on that day so I can just play with this thing and get to know it and scour the UI and Zelda. And, you know, I'm excited for things like, apparently, all those downloads can happen in the background now, so you can put Zelda in on your cart, no install, play that immediately as soon as you get that thing out of the box, and all the day one stuff will do in the background.
Yeah.
No other modern console you could do that with. When I got...
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, because you can't run a game off of a disc.
Right, and I'm just saying that's cool. That's a thing this console has in its to its advantage in the pro column. So, yeah, I'm very curious. But I've definitely... I can't remember another console launch that sort of brought with it as many unanswered questions.
Yeah, like, it is just, like, sort of, like... It feels like everyone is sort of, like, sitting on pins and needles, just like, what... Like, is this thing just going to blow up when it comes out? Like, what is going on? Why do we know nothing about this and it's out in, like, a handful of days? Like, I feel like I have a way, way, way better understanding of what fucking Horizon Zero Dawn is than I do anything about the Switch.
Yeah. One other kind of fun note to make is I have been on the fence about whether to buy a Pro Controller for this thing. And I had not pre-ordered one yet. And then when all the coverage started, both because of the issue with the left Joy-Con, but also just hearing that the Pro Controller is apparently really good. And I'm like, it's the same with the system. Like, I'll probably want it eventually. Might as well get it now. But by that point, all the pre-orders in America were sold out.
Okay.
On a whim, I looked it up on Amazon Japan, and I could get it from there, and it's actually cheaper than it would be buying in America because of exchange rate and taxes. Huh. So I've got it'll come like a couple days after the console gets here, but I will have one, and I would recommend if you want a Pro Controller, I think they're still available on Amazon Japan. That's not a bad way to do it.
Sure,
because I don't think there's any reason why it wouldn't work. I mean, it's all universal. There's no region locking. There's nothing on there that would be in Japanese that you couldn't read. So you could do that. It'll be coming here. The console comes out March 3rd on a Friday. I'll get that controller in at the latest on Monday. But, you know, I think that's totally fine, and that's a good way to do it, because for some reason they didn't make as many of those as there are consoles, and it's hard to get them, so, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway. But, yeah, it'll be
Nintendo
fun.
Nintendo in supply constraint issues. How long it's have we been here?
It's still... I have a Switch coming. It was easier for me to get that, and I still can't get the fucking NES Classic. It's
right,
insane. Yeah. It's insane that that is the scenario. It is easier to get a fucking Nintendo... It will be easier to get that on launch than it was to get the NES Classic on launch.
Has, like, Nintendo... in, like, modern history ever had a single hardware launch that did not have supply constraint issues? The Wii U. The Wii U didn't.
Yeah.
For other reasons.
For other reasons. I mean, there's iteration ones, right? Like, the new 3DS XL did not, like, if you didn't pre-order it, it might have been hard on launch day, but that's a standard thing. But you could pre-order it as long as you wanted. But yeah, other than that, like, for an actual, like, new cold turkey console, no. Yeah. I mean, they're bad at it.
It's really weird.
It's weird. And, you know, it seems like they're doing okay by the Switch. Like, there was a solid 2-day window where you could pre-order the Switch. You know, there will be ones available for midnight launches. You'd have to, like, camp out, but I think you could if you worked really hard and you hadn't pre-ordered one. There is a chance you could get one. So that puts it above some other ones. Like, the Wii was out of sale for months.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I couldn't get a Wii, like, when it, like, anywhere close to when it launched, because it was just all constantly out of sale.
Yeah, and it looks like the Switch is not going to be that kind of scenario.
Yeah.
But who knows? I mean, if it takes off like the Wii did, you know, you never know. And they do have quite a fucking system seller to market this thing with in Breath of the Wild. And I know, again, it's technically also on Wii U. A lot of the audience that might buy a Switch does not own a Wii U. So it's going to be interesting to see. But yeah, so Switch is coming next week. That'll be part of our topic next time, is talking about that. Yeah. Maybe I can bring it over, use the kickstand mode, and you and I can play some snipper clips or something.
Sure, yeah, live on the podcast.
Live on the podcast, yeah. So we'll see. I mean, that's actually one of the things I'm kind of looking forward to doing is I can actually show you the console because I can just bring it with me. Yeah. Anyway, so that'll be neat. But let's go ahead and move on to another Nintendo-related topic, and that is a little mini Zelda retrospective. Like I said, I've played a lot of Zelda games recently. And those are, if you want to know, I talked about this 2 weeks ago on the podcast that I just started a run through Link to the Past, which I had never played to completion.
Yeah.
Well, I played that to completion, And I was on such an insane, incredible high after that game, because that is one of the 10 best games ever made, and I would fight for that. That for just a phenomenal game. And I was like, I have to play more. So then I played A Link Between Worlds, which is the 3DS sequel to that. Phenomenal. I did my 3DS countdown a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
This would, I have to amend that top 10, this would be in the top 3 with Mario 3D Land and Fire Emblem Awakening, and it might be better than either of those.
Okay.
It's unbelievably good. I would come
that
out...
That Dark Overworld remix is real fucking good, huh?
Oh my god!
It's real fucking good,
we'll
huh?
talk about the overall soundtrack, like, that is probably my favorite Zelda soundtrack, because you get these amazing remixes of all the Link to the Past stuff, but then all the new stuff is so great. Like, that game has more saxophone in it than any other game score I can think of.
Other than Gravity Rush 2.
Oh, Gravity Rush 2 does have a lot of saxophone.
Yes, it does.
But, like, you're going through the dungeons with Link, and there's just, like, smooth sax playing in the background. It's amazing. That game, if you own a 3DS, play it. If you don't own a 3DS, buy it and then play this. It's that is an amazing game. And then I went back to the past again and played Link's Awakening for the Game Boy Color. Played on my 3DS, yes. But... so I played
Link's
all of
Awakening
these...
DX for the Game Boy Color.
DX, yes. So I played all of these on my 3DS, and I still, like, I feel like none of this satiated me. Like, I wanted to play more and more and more. I got hooked on Zelda so hard through these games, and so now I'm actually replaying Ocarina of Time on the 3DS, because I didn't want to start another new one, because I don't think I would have time to finish it before the Switch launches, but I think I can, like, casually play Ocarina of Time and just have fun seeing some of the things again in it.
Yeah.
And I've been doing that, and that's also just for me to study, you know, Ocarina of Time was the first Zelda game I played to completion, then going back and doing the 2D ones, and then I wanted to try Ocarina of Time again, because it is so fascinating to connect that to A Link to the Past.
Yeah.
And how that just, that transition, it's kind of like, you know, Super Metroid to Metroid Prime, or Mario World to Mario 64 or something. There's, that transition is so fucking fascinating to
yeah.
me. But anyway, I love these games, and one thing you'll notice about the three I played in the last 2 weeks is those are all 2D Zelda games, and...
I mean, you would not have been able to play three 3D Zelda games in 2 weeks. That is not physically possible.
No, those are much longer games. I think there's something about the way the 2D Zeldas are structured, particularly Link to the Past, because everything else borrows from Link to the Past. Even the 3D ones, obviously. Link to the Past is, like, the prototypical Zelda game.
Yeah, it is the one that sort of, like, popularizes the basic structure of them. Yeah.
Right. There's something about that I think unlocked for me the genius of the Zelda series in a way I respected and liked a lot when I played Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, but I don't think I fully felt until I played the 2D games, which is just that overall gameplay loop that Link to the Past has, that Link Between Worlds, Link's Awakening, all these have, of, you know, you have this open overworld gated by, you know, things that are put there by, like, the hand of the designer, but at its best, the hand of the designer feels invisible in those games. And it's like, you go through it, and, you know, you find, I need the bow and arrow here, and I find it here, and I do, you know, this.
Yeah.
And I think the overall progression of the dungeons, and I think the dungeons are just so phenomenally designed in A Link to the Past, in A Link Between Worlds, to a slightly lesser extent, Link's Awakening. Please don't hurt me, Link's Awakening fans. I love this game to death, too. It's up there for me. But I just don't think it's quite the same par in dungeon design. Other things I think it does even better. But, like, you know, getting into a dungeon and not knowing what you're doing at first, and so you just start exploring, and you find the map, and you're like, okay, I've got this. There's all these rooms to explore, but if I take it one piece at a time, I can get where I need to go. And you find the dungeon, you know, compass, and you're like, this is great, and you start finding small keys, and then you're like, I have to find every piece of treasure, so I have to do this, and this is on this floor, and this is on this floor. And, like, each dungeon is, you know, its own very different thing, and at their best, I think, and this is something A Link Between Worlds on the 3DS does phenomenally well, those dungeons have a propulsive quality to them, where once it gets going, like, it's slow at first, but you get so hooked, it's like reading a good book where the final stages of a dungeon, you go through so fast, because it's just, it all starts clicking together and clicking together, and again, it's the hand of the designer is there, but feels so invisible in making you understand all this, and... I find that gameplay loop so incredibly addictive. And, you know, I tore through Link to the Past. I tore through Link Between Worlds. I played most of Link Between Worlds in 2 days on a weekend where that's like all I did for 2 days because I love that. And then Link's Awakening took me a little bit to get started with because you have to adjust a little bit. You know, it's a Game Boy game. It's a little different just in terms of how it looks and is controlled. But I also just really got into the basic gameplay loop of that. And then going back to Ocarina of Time and realizing, oh, Ocarina of Time is the same thing, just done in 3D and bigger.
Yeah.
And it made me realize, you know, so much of the genius of that game again and re-respecting it and getting into it on that same level. But also, for me, why I love and respect Ocarina of Time and all these things. For me, there's something about, like, the directness and simplicity of, like, 2D Zelda that really drives a lot of those qualities. And Ocarina of Time, to a certain extent, replaces those things with other qualities. Like, the world is more beautiful to explore, and there might be more nooks and crannies to go behind and things like that. And the dungeons can have a very different... They have a much sort of slower pace to them because they are, just by virtue of being in 3D, bigger and more complex. You know, but... you know, then it just comes down to a taste thing, and I guess on some level, I really love the 2D Zeldas in a way that I love the 3D Zeldas, but just the 2Ds are maybe more up my alley. But I love how they kind of work in conversation with one another.
Yeah.
And I like that with A Link Between Worlds, Nintendo kind of finally went back for the first time in about 15 years and made a proper 2D Zelda, and I hope they do another one of those in the future, because that's a, I think it's a really valid way to keep doing that franchise. But, you know, now I've played 5 Zelda games to completion, and they're, you know, 5 of the generally more beloved ones. So, you know, I feel like I have a good idea of these games, and I can finally feel like, because I marathoned 3 of these in 2 weeks, I can finally call myself a Zelda fan, a true Zelda fan. So, yeah, but that's been my experience in the last few weeks.
It's really interesting to hear all that, like, for me, because I feel like part of, like, a lot of my, like, part of, like, what is wrapped in my video game history is, like, this slow realization over the course of, like, my youth into, like, young, like, I guess, like, teenager dumb, is, like, slowly learning that I had thought for such a long time that I was a true Zelda fan, and then realizing I just really like Ocarina, I love Ocarina of Time, and I really like Link to the Past, and that's kind of where the buck stops. And I respect a lot of the other games, and I've enjoyed a lot of Wind Waker, I've enjoyed a lot of Majora's Mask, I've enjoyed a lot of Link's Awakening DX, and like, Minish Cap is one of the ones, other ones I played quite a bit. And, like, I enjoyed those games, but I've only ever finished Ocarina of Time and Link to the Past, even though I've started every other Zelda game I played multiple times. Like fucking, I have tried so hard to finish, or, like, before I, like, realized just how much I just didn't like the game, I tried to finish Twilight Princess so hard. I fucking so, just, like, I started that game, like, 3 times and got so far into it each time, and just every single time I got to around the same point, it was just like, I can't do this, this game is fucking shit. But, like, that's kind of neither here nor there. And it's interesting for me to hear, you, like, what you're all you're talking about, because for me, like, the dungeons are kind of, like, the least interesting part of Zelda to me. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons why I've never really loved the 2D Zelda games, even though I like Link to the Past a lot, because I played Link to the Past on the Game Boy Advance. And even, like, before that, whenever I would be in a hotel room when I was a kid, and they would have those, like, Super Nintendo controllers connected to the TV that you could, like, rent, like, minutes or whatever of games, like, Link to the Past and Super Mario World were the two I always would play that way. And so, like, I played through the beginning, like, hours, like, first hour or something of Link to the Past, God knows how many times when I was a kid when we would go on a bunch of road trips and stuff. Just, like, I really like those games. But there is something about, to me, Zelda is so much about, and this comes more from Ocarina of Time, it's about the world and exploring the world and being out there. And it's like, the dungeons are, can be cool and fun, and I like a lot of the dungeons, but it's never, like, what really attracts me to it. And for me, like, Zelda, the best two moments in Zelda games are the, like, moments you're going up to and right about to enter a dungeon, and the moments where you leave a dungeon and go back out into the world. Those are the two moments in Zelda games. It's like, that's what I live for. And the dungeons are, like, I enjoy them, and then eventually I hit a point, like, when it's generally around after you do, like, the thing that every Zelda game has, where it's like you have your first set of, like, 3 or 4 dungeons or whatever that you have to go through, like, that first set of objectives, and then you clear that, and then you get, like, your Dark World or Mature Link or, like, whatever, like, thing that Zelda game does, and then you get, like, your second set of objectives open up, like, almost like fucking clockwork, I will lose momentum, like, 2 to 3 dungeons into that second set of objectives, and I will stop playing the game. It's like the Water Temple portion, not because, like, the Water Temple is bad, like, obviously I've finished Ocarina of Time multiple times, but, like, when I replay it, I always lose steam around the Water Temple, not because the Water Temple is bad. I've played through the Water Temple multiple times, I can play through the Water Temple in my sleep, but I, like, the momentum of the game to me slows down there because I'm not discovering the world anew. It's like, now you're in the like, okay, I'm going to, like, you have to hit all these dungeons because you've seen the bulk of what the game has to offer. Now it's like the trial of going through all these different dungeons, and, like, to me, that's where Zelda always loses its magic. So I think that's why I've never managed to, like, be a guy who finishes Zelda games. I'm always the guy who plays halfway through a Zelda game, thinking I'm going to finish it, and then just lose momentum and stop without ever really attending it.
So here's what's so fascinating about this to me.
Yeah.
I thought that was my opinion for a long time, where even though I loved playing Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, I would say to myself, the dungeons are almost like the price I pay to see everything else.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I'm going through Ocarina of Time again with this new view from A Link to the Past in these games, and I'm loving the dungeons. And I love the overworld as much as I always did, because I think that's fascinating. But I have this other love now for, I feel like I understand the genius of that dungeon design in a way I didn't before. And I think it just took me going through the 2D games, and the 2D game where that system was invented, frankly, and perfected. I mean, I know that's in the original NES game, but really updated and perfected. To understand that. And to me, it's all about the balance. That what keeps the pace of Zelda games so good for me, and what actually throws me off in some of the later 3D Zelda games, is I love, you know, being out in the overworld, exploring, getting certain collectibles, which are mostly kept for the overworld and aren't in dungeons, like heart pieces and stuff, and doing that. And then, you know, at any point where that starts to feel tiring, in the best Zelda games, I feel like that's when your next step is to do a dungeon. Or to do the, you know, the preamble to a dungeon, which is always a part of it, too. And I love that. And each dungeon is something new and exciting. And then when you're done with a dungeon, usually you're ready to go back in the overworld. And it's like, okay, I have these things I want to go check and do now. And I love that balance and that push and pull. And I frankly think that makes the games, to me, really compelling and well-paced to play. But it also means that there is no other series like Zelda in terms of that structure. Like, what A Link to the Past does, and then what the other games do in basically recreating the structure of A Link to the Past, the closest comparison is the Metroid series. Because you have these sort of, you know, pseudo-open worlds where all the collectibles are out there for you to find, but some of it is gated by progress through items you get. And one of the things that I love about Metroid, and I love equally, and I think I realized in Zelda when I played A Link to the Past, because this is something that I'm addicted to in the Metroid games, is that those are games full of what we would now call collectibles, but every single one matters. There is no such thing as a junk collectible in these games, because what you get is like a heart piece, and that'll allow you to literally be better at the game. Or you can get the pieces that let you have a stronger Master Sword or things like that, a stronger shield. And so everything you find out, or like in Metroid where, you know, you get the missiles and then the stronger missiles and you get all your equipment and you get, you know, the big collectible in Metroid games is the health, not health packs, what do they call them? I forget. But like, they add to your health bar, kind of like heart containers, you know, things like that. And I think that's an incredible structure, and I love that about those two series. It also means that that's an incredibly tough thing to do. Like, I think the tightrope act the best Zelda games are doing with that balance between a world that feels rich and lived in, and I do think the best Zelda games, you know, the Link to the Past world, the Link's Awakening world, and the Ocarina of Time world, and I think Majora's Mask as well, feel so lived in and rich.
Yeah.
And that balance with all that collectible area stuff, and then that balance with all the dungeons and all the story that goes in and out of those, that's really, really, really hard to do. And you see that also in, and Metroid doesn't have dungeons, but it has that same similar structure. And you've seen that be the downfall of Metroid in some cases, where it's not just that those games don't sell great. What that series does is incredibly difficult to pull off and be like true to the truest version of itself. And I think, you know, like, I have trouble getting into a Twilight Princess or something, for instance, because you can play it for hours and hours and hours and not quite get into what you think of as the main kind of structure of a Zelda game. And that's not necessarily bad, but, you know, it's not...
In the case of Twilight Princess, it is bad. That game has an unbelievably long opening. I don't... I mean, I'm sure there are, but I still say there can't be people that enjoy the opening to Twilight Princess. Like, there are good things about Twilight Princess, for sure, but, like, the opening is insanely tedious. And from what I understand, that's true of Skyward Sword as well. I never played that one.
Well, in Skyward Sword, for instance, there are people who love many things about that game, but, and this is something that's true of certain other modern Zelda games, where they'll say, like, but it winds up being a little too linear, too hand-holdy, and the thing is, it's just, that's a really tough thing to do multiple times. And I think it's why it's so good that Breath of the Wild is going in such a radically different direction. And it also makes something like A Link Between Worlds, the 3DS game from a couple years ago, to me, such a magic act that they're able to recreate that. And in some areas, even sort of one-up what Link to the Past is doing. I don't think it's necessarily a better game overall, but that it can come into the same ballpark is insane to me. Because Link to the Past is such a singular sort of achievement to me. And then Ocarina of Time kind of as the 3D version of that is also like, that's lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
But Zelda has captured that lightning in a bottle a surprising number of times for the level of difficulty at which I think those games execute at on a creative game design level.
Yeah. I think it's just for me, like, I tend to fall more on, like, the back half of Zelda games just get tedious. Like, there's something about, like, the... Because I think it is also, it is the, like... And, like, it's even more exaggerated in the 2D Zeldas because the dungeons are smaller. But it is that, like, I get the map, I get the compass, I get the dungeon item, I get the boss key, go through the boss door, kill the boss. But like that pacing can be good and propulsive at the early parts of the game. But, like, for me, I've always found in the later dungeons, it's just, like, it feels like going through the motions almost. It's just, like, I know how these dungeons go. I just go through them. And, like, there's not... And I think it's also there's just something about in 2D, like the sense of exploration is just like by definition sort of muted when you're playing it from that top down perspective. Where for me, like, it is that sense of like being in the environment and exploring it and like having that experience of what Miyamoto has sort of said and what is his inspiration for making the original Legend of Zelda was like, you know, having imaginary adventures and playing in your backyard. And to me, like, there's something about the 2D Zeldas that can't quite get that sensation that, like, I felt when I played Ocarina of Time. Was like, this is what it is. Like, this is running around in Hyrule Field is, like, you have captured that sensation so perfectly.
But see, to me, they're doing separate things. Like, I agree with you that Ocarina of Time and the 3D Zeldas in general do a better job of that sense of exploration.
Yeah.
I agree because there's just, by virtue of what they are, you can do that more. And that's a wonderful thing about those games. But to me, then, I don't find the dungeons quite as enjoyable because what makes, to me, the dungeon design so addictive in the 2D Zelda games is that they're like great puzzles. And a great puzzle, you know, like a Tetris or something, as much as you do it, it doesn't quite get old because you can have infinite permutations on it. And, you know, A Link to the Past, yeah, like, most of the story happens in, like, the first hour of that game, and then you have to go find the seven sages, and that's most of the game. And then it's, yeah, like, little stories you kind of make for yourself in the middle there. But what makes that so great is every one of those seven dungeons is so unique, has such fascinating core mechanics, has this great sense of propulsion to it once you get into it, and I think the overhead stuff allows, like, the basic, I don't even know what to describe it as, but the puzzle solving is probably the best way to put it, of whatever the mechanic of that dungeon is, whatever the core thing is, when you have that top down, you can get, frankly, more complex with some of those basic functions of what's going on, and you can kind of see the patterns in it in a more, to me, like, intellectually compelling way. And then, you know, the dungeons in the 3D Zelda games often have a lot of those same qualities, but they come across to me in very different ways. You know, like I was playing through Dodongo's Cavern today,
yeah,
in Ocarina of Time. Great dungeon, but it definitely has an inherently different feeling because, you know, one of the things you do in, like, the Link to the Past style games is that, you know, the screen physically has to move,
yeah,
every square. And that means that every square you are in is an experience unto itself.
Yeah,
and that can be a really fascinating way to do it. You know, and just that, like, something like Link's Awakening, which was made for this little, you know, the little handheld Game Boy and Game Boy Color, could capture that same kind of experience is a masterclass in game design to me. Like, I think Link to the Past, moment for moment, is as well-designed a game I have ever seen. There is no slack or give in that game to me whatsoever.
Yeah, because even though I really like that game, I wouldn't quite go that far with it. Like, I definitely do get fatigued by it by the end, for sure.
But, you know, like, and Link Between Worlds operate. One of the great things Link Between Worlds adds to it is the way that game has kind of it's got a different story, different characters and stuff, but it's got a similar structure where first you have to get the Master Sword, and then you have to get the seven descendants of the sages. But what Link Between Worlds does that's really interesting is that you can do any of the dungeons in any order once,
right,
you get to those main seven. And so that game has a whole other, like, feeling to it where it's just kind of, you kind of go where your whims guide you. And that also makes that game feel, in some ways, even more exciting to me because it's just, I can kind of play this in any order or orientation. The one flaw with that is the way they open that up in that game is that you can basically have access to all the items at the start. So there's not as many, like, substantive rewards I feel like you're getting out of the dungeons. But then the dungeons are so well designed. Like, there's this one in Link Between Worlds that's the ice dungeon where it's like eight floors and it's all built on, there's a central, like, pillar where there's these ice floats that are going up and down like a little escalator.
Yeah.
And you can kind of go to all the floors from the start, and then there's that central area you have to get to, you know, be going back up and down. And, like, that one is an incredible, like, you are walking on air after finishing that breath of, you know, just amazing feat of game design. Mm-hmm. Like, honestly, at their best, Zelda games to me operate on me the same way like the Portal games do. Huh. And when you're out of a room in Portal, you're like, oh my god, that was incredible in how that worked out my intellect and sort of my reflexes in this. That's how I feel with a really good Zelda dungeon.
I've just never had that sensation from them. Even though like I recognize what you're saying and that like I recognize that they are built that way, I've just never gotten that satisfaction from completing them.
And see, here's the thing. What they're doing well to me is such a specific thing. Playing this much Zelda makes me a little surprised that Zelda is as popular a series as it is. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I love Metroid. I completely understand why Metroid is not the biggest selling Nintendo series.
Yeah.
It does not have the easy accessibility of a Mario. But I think Zelda does not have the same easy accessibility either. And I think it does come down to certain taste differences and things like that. What works for you and what doesn't. And I think it's kind of cool, but also surprising to me that Zelda is as popular as it is. And some of that is just that there are so many flavors of Zelda. No Zelda fan in the world loves every Zelda game equally, you know? Like, Thomas, my brother, who's a huge Zelda fan, does not generally like the 2D games to the level I love them. Like, he really loves the 3D games and some of those things.
He even likes Twilight Princess.
He loves Twilight Princess.
Monster. The monster!
But, you know, it's like, the Zelda, it's a series with so many different flavors that one person cannot love all of it the same way. And that's a fascinating thing to me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, one of the things I was saying to Thomas the other day, and I was trying to articulate this, and I think I've been able to articulate it better now, is that even though Ocarina of Time is structurally so close to Link to the Past,
yeah,
the 3D Zelda games feel the most different to me of all the like Nintendo 3D franchises versus their 2D counterparts. Like, Super Metroid to Metroid Prime, those sort of, in my mind, feel like the same experience actualized in two very different ways. You know, the 2D Mario games to the 3D Mario games, same kind of thing, even though technically Mario 64 could not be more different in form than a Mario World.
Yeah.
But Link to the Past to Ocarina of Time, superficially, there are endless similarities, and yet what I get out of those games and 3D Zelda in general versus 2D Zelda tends to feel very different, and I think that's because the aims of that franchise, when you actualize it in sort of those two mediums, winds up just the atmosphere and the feeling you get out of it just is inherently very different.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing to me. But there are cases where there's links, like, I don't mean that as a pun, but like, you know, one of the things I love is that Link's Awakening, I love in a very similar way to what I love about Majora's Mask, which both of those games are like metaphysical masterpieces. I don't think I can point to any other video games that explore sort of dreamscapes and like, frankly, Freudian psychology and things like that as well as those two games. Like, I said often when I talk about Majora's Mask on here and elsewhere that it's extremely Lynchian. It so feels like David Lynch directed a Zelda game, and Link's Awakening feels like that even more. And I was reading up about the development, and, oh, they were really inspired by Twin Peaks. And like, oh, of course they were. That's incredible. But most games would only be able to pay lip service to that. You know, Link's Awakening is, spoiler for a 30-year-old game, it's literally a dream, is what the story of that game is.
The name of the game is Link's Awakening.
I know, yeah.
I mean, obviously, like the game opens with him supposed to be waking up on the beach or whatever, but yeah.
Well, in Japan, the name of the game is Dream Island, so...
Okay, maybe it's that it's a little bit more directed that time,
It's like Yumeo something, but yeah.
Yumeo Shima.
Yeah. So anyway, you got that. But like, it's literally a dream world. But like, what it does with that is, it's the best version of that where I think so often you get like dreams explored in media in a way where they don't feel like dreams because it's like too structured and too directed and too much this means this and that means that and that means that. And the like David Lynch, Louis Buñuel surrealism model of dreamscapes is that there have to be incongruities.
Yeah, like there has to be a lot of nonsense in there because dreams are a lot of nonsense.
And Link's Awakening is chock full of that in a way that is consistently surprising and fascinating, and that is maybe the weirdest game I've ever seen from like a AAA publisher. Link's Awakening, just like the way it has all these cameos from Mario characters.
There's a fucking chain chomp you run into on like literally the second fucking screen of that game.
Yes, and you know, you have side-scrolling levels where you're just jumping through and doing crazy shit, and you will talk to, you know, one of the first people in the Mabel Village, the main town. He'll say, "Hi, Link, I'm going to get lost in a few hours, so please make sure to rescue me," and later you meet him, he's like, "I told you I'd get lost." That's completely, that feels like, I can see that in a David Lynch movie.
Yeah.
That like literally feels like like a plot of a Twin Peaks thing, that someone would tell Agent Cooper that, and then he'd get it later. And so that level of, like, psychoanalysis that winds up going on through the game is fascinating. And that in Link's Awakening, I think there's a very clear link between, like, the dungeon design and then what you're doing in terms of this dream world, and how it all kind of gets more and more focused by the end, right before the actual awakening. And Majora's Mask works in much the same way, even though that's not a literal dream world. It does a lot of those same things in a really fascinating way, where neither of those games, I think, you're supposed to at all take literally.
Yeah.
Like Thomas was saying to me, he finds the end of Link's Awakening very sad, and I get that, because basically you're being told none of this exists and it disappears. But to me, it's like, it's not representative of anything, so I don't get, like, a specific emotion out of it that way.
Yeah.
Other than sort of, like, wonder at what I just witnessed, because it's clearly going for something more than this is sad, or this is happy, or this is triumphant.
Yeah, because for me, when you say, like, the events of Majora's Mask are not literally a dream, like, I almost feel like you can't fully make that argument just because, because I've never technically beaten that game, but like the opening of Majora's Mask is so much like, it's kind of like with Link's Awakening. This is a Link that's already been on an adventure. In the case of Link's Awakening, I guess it would be the original Legend of Zelda. In the case of Majora's Mask, it's the Link from Ocarina of Time, who's like, so he's already been on an adventure, and he's just like wandering through the forest looking for someone that's Navi, probably, is like the implication of Majora's Mask, but they never say why. And you're just wandering in this mysterious forest, and then you just encounter all this crazy stuff, and it's like, it's so much a, like, it feels like a 19th century American short story by, like, Nathaniel Hawthorne or something, of, like, you go through the forest, and while you're going through the forest, you go into the subconscious / the dream world. It's like, you are not in reality anymore once you go into the forest. Like, you are in this, like, subprimal state.
And all I meant by that is that Link's Awakening literally ends with him waking up.
Yeah, it never tips its hand, but, like, for me, like, Majora's Mask, it's like, it feels like none of this is literally happening. Like, you are in another dimension or something.
I completely agree. The great thing about what makes Majora's Mask such a great companion piece to Ocarina of Time is it's a dream from the perspective of Ocarina of Time, where Ocarina of Time is literal, all that stuff in that world diegetically exists.
Yeah.
And then in Majora's Mask, it's all recontextualized in this slightly off-kilter, surrealistic dreamscape atmosphere, where, like, you have the Zoras, but they're not quite the Zoras you knew when you were awake. They stand for something else. And all of that is super fascinating to me, and I think it's the Zelda series in its different flavors just kind of allows itself to go places that I find fascinating. Like, you know, to me, the best Zelda narratives are the ones that aren't necessarily literally happening in text boxes, but are told through the world.
Yeah.
And it's something it seems like they're very much going for in Breath of the Wild, and I love that about it. But, Link to the Past and the games before it have pretty minimalistic narratives. And then you get to Link's Awakening, which everyone at Nintendo will tell you that, Eiji Aonuma said this several times, that is the birth of storytelling in Nintendo games, because that's the first one that had a heavy amount of scripting to it and stuff like that. And you see the influence that had, not just in later Zelda games, but I think in other Nintendo games in terms of how they weave story through their narratives, which Nintendo has never had a traditional approach to narrative. And God bless them for it. I love that about Nintendo games. But
That is one of the places where I think Zelda kind of went off, 3D Zelda went off the mark, is like, accepting Skyward Sword, because I haven't played that, so I can't speak from experience. But like, the Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask is literally like a side thing, but like from Ocarina of Time to Wind Waker to Twilight Princess, like it got more and more heavy-handed with the storytelling. Yeah. Whereas it's like with Ocarina of Time, I think it's mostly striking the right balance, though there are some sequences in Ocarina of Time that just like is too long of exposition. Like I think after you beat the Forest Temple and you meet like the new Deku Tree, like there's sections like that, there's like, this is a lot of fucking text. Or like right when you become Adult Link and the Sage of Light is talking to you, you're like, fucking get it, like, fucking go through it, old man. But instead of there being, like, two or three scenes like that in Ocarina of Time, and there's, like, more of that in Wind Waker, that's, like, the first 5 hours of Twilight Princess just feels like that, of, like, holy shit. And it's one of the main reasons why, and I'm glad they're doing this with Breath of the Wild, I felt they've needed voice acting in 3D Zelda for a long time, because if you're going to do that style of storytelling, you cannot have the pacing of these text boxes in, like, your directed cutscenes, because it kills the pacing of your story.
Yeah, because the best storytelling to me in Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask is what I think of as impressionistic, where like, you know, there are some cutscenes in Ocarina of Time that just cut to my heart, but it's because they're done through sort of visuals and sound and silences. Like the scene when you're leaving the forest and Saria gives her you her ocarina. It's like two text boxes, but what matters there is like the glance they exchange and the silence of the forest in that moment and sort of the way the music resonates there. There's just scenes like that, or you know,
some or like I feel like any of the scenes where you meet Sheik and she gives you whatever like the song for the next dungeon and like has like some of that text, but it's the camera sort of like flying around while she's talking to you, and then you play the song together.
It honestly is, I think, one of the things that's always held me back from like Wind Waker and Twilight Princess. Is like I've played a chunk of both of those games, more of Wind Waker over the years. But because the story and telling in those games gets a little more conventional, I don't know if I have as much interest in it.
Yeah.
But there's very little conventional about the way like the five Zelda games I've played to completion tell their stories, and I don't think it's a coincidence that I've played those five games to completion.
Yeah.
Even like A Link Between Worlds, which has a lot more text than Link's Awakening or you know, A Link to the Past, because it's a game made in 2013 and they're going to do that. It's still like minimalistic enough that you get right into the game, and you know the best story stuff is still done in alternate methods. And that game has a phenomenal conclusion and a really powerful ending and some really nice things about it. So, you know, but yeah, again, it's this thing of multiple flavors of Zelda, and clearly we're getting a new one in 6 days.
Yeah,
that is clearly inspired by certain moments of Zelda past. But you know, I am primarily excited for Breath of the Wild, not even as a Zelda fan, which I do consider myself now, but just that that game looks and sounds and seems to play like nothing I have ever seen. It looks kind of out of this world, just on a level of like the trailers we've seen and some of the gameplay videos. It's like, I want to play that because that looks like it's something doing something radically new with this, you know, what has become a very codified genre, the open world genre, which Zelda certainly is a progenitor of. But now it feels like it's coming back around full circle. So
yeah, for me, what's exciting about Breath of the Wild, this like is definitely from a lot of the previews, is the sensation I'm getting is like what I talked about earlier of Miyamoto saying like the inspiration for Legend of Zelda was like playing in your backyard and like being on this imaginary adventure and trying to capture that feeling with like the technology they had at the time. And then for me, Ocarina of Time is the one that like did that and like got that, and it was obviously like part of that is me playing it at the right age and everything. So I mean, I played Link to the Past, not to completion, but I started playing that game before I ever played Ocarina, so it's like I still went in that order, and Ocarina of Time is like what solidified it. And then like the thing is that all the subsequent 3D Zeldas, again with the exception of Majora's, which is a weird side thing, have like been trying to recapture the Ocarina thing, and for me they've never gotten close to succeeding, and it's only when they go off the path with like the weirder stuff in Wind Waker that kind of works for me. And that's why like Twilight Princess is so just obsessed with trying to recapture the sensation of Ocarina of Time that like it never gets past it. And to me, what it sounds like Breath of the Wild is doing is going back to that idea of like what inspires Legend of Zelda, what inspired Link to the Past, and what inspired Ocarina of Time, which is that core fantasy of playing in your backyard and seeing the world you live in as this like world you can adventure in, and that like every single mountain there's like there's something there, like every single ditch there's something there, like, and reapproaching that idea with like a fresh mind and a fresh perspective and making a game from that, like that's what Zelda has needed to do for since literally 1998, and they just have never fucking they never did it again. It's like the only time they succeeded is when they tried to go off another source of inspiration like Majora's Mask. It's like whenever they tried to copy Ocarina of Time, they didn't need to copy Ocarina of Time. They needed to try to capture what Ocarina of Time was trying to capture in their own way. And it sounds like hopefully, finally, that is what they are fucking doing. And if so, I'm very excited for that.
Yeah, I'm so excited to play it. And, you know, I'm excited to continue playing through the Zelda back catalog when I have free moments because, boy, these last 2 weeks, I have been so happy just on my 3DS playing Zelda games. Sometimes I just need that cleanse of, like, I'm not going to play new games for a couple weeks. I just need to go to the back catalog of, like, classics and see some of that, because it's really, it's inspiring for me in a lot of ways, and I love that. And it kind of reconnects me to my love of video games in an intense way. And I do at one point want to go and play some of the 3D Zelda games when I have time to do some of them in greater depth. And I don't feel like Breath of the Wild is going to retroactively ruin them for me because it's clearly such a different thing.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by them and I want to see more of them. But, man, I've had a lot of fun going through this series. And it is such a fascinating series to play and think about. And, you know, at its best, those older games like Link's Awakening and Link to the Past, they don't feel aged at all. Like, even Link's Awakening takes maybe, you know, a little bit to just adjust to because it is a Game Boy Color game. It's a beautiful one. But, you know, it has a limited amount of controls to use, you know, buttons and things like that. But once you get into it, it's like that melts away to me so fucking fast. And the great thing is, you know, at least four of the five games I've played, Link Between Worlds is probably too new to say anything about with, but the other four, there is some Zelda fan I've heard many times will claim any of those four as their favorite Zelda game.
Yeah.
And I see every one of those 100%.
I mean, Ocarina of Time is the right one, but you can like the other ones too.
Like, I don't even really know of those five which one I would say is my favorite. I don't know if I could begin to rank that list. I might lean towards Link to the Past and then Ocarina of Time, but it's like, it's so tough, and they're all so fascinating and fantastic in their own way. And, you know, it's only made me more and more excited for Breath of the Wild on this upcoming Friday. So,
but if there's one other thing you can say about those five Zelda games, there's only one of them where you can steal Shovel from the shopkeeper, and that's Link's Awakening, and that's fucking cool.
You can steal the fucking bow from him.
Yeah. Crazy. I was just thinking about the shovel because a couple of days ago, I told you this before we started the podcast, I put in my copy of Link's Awakening DX into my Game Boy Advance SP. Unfortunately, discovered that game crashes once I hit like a certain number of screens away from where that game starts, which is kind of weird, but I can get to the shopkeeper, and as soon as I got to the shopkeeper, I was like, oh, right. Like, the thing I did over and over in this game when I started it over was I just kept stealing shit from the fucking shopkeeper, because that's really cool, and more games should let you do that.
It's hilarious. And there's so many just little incongruities like that in Link's Awakening that are so fun and fascinating to see. There really is nothing like Link's Awakening. It is such a singular game. I love it. Just that was made on the original Game Boy in 1993 or whatever.
Yeah, it's pretty mind-boggling.
Because it's huge. Like, I don't know if Koholint Island is, like, bigger in landmass than the Hyrule of Link to the Past, but it feels, like, bigger and denser in a weird way.
Yeah.
And for that to be on a Game Boy cart, it's just nuts. Nuts.
Maybe it was a bit too much for a Game Boy cart, unfortunately.
Yeah, now that's dead, yeah. This is the great thing about Virtual Console now, is I don't have to worry about the cartridges dying.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, anyway. Anything else we want to say about Zelda before we move on to our last topic?
Ocarina of Time is a really good game.
Yes, absolutely. So if somehow you haven't played Ocarina of Time, you should.
Yes, yeah.
God, the 3DS remake is so fucking beautiful. I just want to say that again. Like, that game looks so fucking beautiful on that system. The 3D works so well with it. I didn't say this about Link Between Worlds. Link Between Worlds probably has the best use of 3D on the 3DS.
Huh.
Like, I think Mario 3D Land does more with 3D mechanically, but, like, just the way, like, when... Like, because Link Between Worlds is done, it's at 60 frames per second consistently, and it doesn't lose a beat with that, and it's in 3D. Like, it's eerie how much it just looks like you are looking at, like, little models on screen. It doesn't look like typical graphics or anything. It's really interesting. Kind of like when you watch, like, The Hobbit at 48 frames per second in 3D, and you're like, is Martin Freeman, like, in the room with me? And just things like that. But also, like, you know, one of the great things Link to the Past did was it would have kind of pseudo 3D tiers of things where maybe you go under some stairs and then you go up them, but that's, like, on the same level.
Yeah.
Link Between Worlds has so much fun with that because it can use literal spatial dimensions in 3D. And I think if I were to show any game to kind of prove the 3D capabilities of the 3DS and why they're valuable, I might just boot that one up because I think you can see it the most immediately. Even though, again, I think mechanically, the deeper you get into Mario 3D Land, the more you realize it's really, like, the physics are built around that and you need it to play the game. It's just, it's an interesting thing about that game. So, yeah. And now, it's great because I think the first time I tried playing Link Between Worlds before, I may have even talked about it on the podcast back when it came out, but I had, like, the old 3DS that didn't, the 3D, they wasn't as good as on the new 3DS.
Right.
And the game kind of, like a lot of 3D games on the old 3DSs, it kind of ghosted for me and gave me a little bit of a headache. The new 3DS, I can play in 3D all day and it doesn't bother me. And that's a great thing about the revision of that console. That's a thing they really fixed. So, all right, let's go ahead and move on.
Let's move on.
To our final and silliest topic of the day, which is, like I said, back when the Nintendo Switch was announced, I started working on what I thought would be a fun little mini topic. And possibly a written article for the site. Like, most of this is actually written up for something else to publish, but I don't know if I'll ever finish it, so I'll deliver it here.
Sure.
Was I ranked all the Nintendo consoles. And it turns out the way I counted them, there are sort of 10. So it is a top 10 list from, like...
Okay.
And I just thought it was a fun thought exercise of, you know, especially because I have obviously not owned every Nintendo console. I am not old enough to have owned an NES or a Super NES and, like, played them when I was a kid. That just, you know, when I was a kid, the first console was, like, an N64. But obviously I know those libraries very well now. And so I kind of was trying to think, if I were to rank, like, the best consoles, what do I think matters? And to me, I kind of had a breakdown of, like, 70%, like, a little over two-thirds of this to me, is the game library. Okay. That is the most important thing, the library for that system. And there's some gray areas, like, how much do you count backwards compatibility? And the answer is probably a little bit. You can't ignore that with the Game Boy Advance, that it also had access to everything else. Yeah. But, you know, a little bit. But overall, game library is the most important thing. Like, 15% is, like, innovation and influence. Like, what did it do for the industry? What kind of things did it introduce that are interesting? Did it, you know, what was innovative about it? And, you know, some consoles get a lot off that. Like, the NES, there is no more innovative device because it, like, birthed modern home console gaming.
Yeah.
But, you know, other ones might not have as much of that, but still matter a lot. 10% is, like, just basic, you know, functionality. Like, this is where the Wii U might get a hit because it's hard to use in some ways.
Right.
But it's where something like the Game Boy Advance SP gets a big boost.
Yeah.
Right? And 5%, the last 5 is just gut feeling of what feels right and wrong.
All right.
And some of this is very raw. I looked over my notes and, like, slightly rearranged things this afternoon, but most of this I wrote, like, 6 months ago. So we'll see if I remember my reasoning.
So I just want to confirm, like, the basic rules for this list is it's both the Nintendo home consoles and their handheld consoles.
Yes.
Like, and I assume, like, are you just taking, if there have been multiple revisions of one of these consoles, are you just going off of what is the best one? Or is it like a combination of all the different versions of those?
A good question. Like, it's all factored in.
Okay.
Like, and certain ones I split out in different ways. Like, at the end of the day, I couldn't figure out how to separate the DS and the 3DS because it's all part of a continuum to me.
Okay.
So those are combined.
That is, those are two different consoles, but okay, that is not an Advance SP situation.
No, but then Game Boy Color is in one, and Game Boy Advance is in a separate one, because I can separate those in my head easier.
Okay, that seems really weirdly subjective.
This was also to get it to, like, exactly 10 with what I had.
Okay, are there any Game & Watches on this?
No.
Okay, your list is broken.
You may proceed. That would be an awful lot.
You may proceed, all right. Sir.
Number 10, bottom of the list, is the Virtual Boy.
Okay.
I've never actually played the Virtual Boy.
Nor have I.
I've played a little bit on an emulator.
I saw a Virtual Boy when I was at the Nintendo New York store. They had one on display. I did not use it because you couldn't use it, but it was there.
They're proud enough to put that on display?
You know, yeah, anyway, I guess. You have to remember history or you are doomed to repeat it, Jonathan.
So this is technically a Nintendo console.
No, actually, it is a Nintendo console. It deserves to be on that list, and it deserves to be where it is on that list.
Yeah, we can all safely agree it's their biggest miss. It came and went pretty much in the same instant, had a small library of unimpressive games, been mostly forgotten by history, swing and a miss. Right?
And it's only now, like, 20 years later, that virtual reality is sort of taking its steps into actually being a thing. So
maybe they
swung slightly early on that one.
Maybe. I will say, I have emulated some of Virtual Boy Wario Land.
Okay.
That's a really cool game, and it's not just like a port of Wario Land. It is its own thing, and it actually is a really clear progenitor of a lot of the side-scrollers on the 3DS, where Wario will jump from the foreground into the background. In particular, the Kirby games like Planet Robobot use that a lot, and it feels like that's something that I think people in Nintendo are aware of that game, even if the larger public is not.
Sure.
So that one's kind of, if you have an emulator for that, it's kind of interesting to see. You obviously cannot play it in 3D, but you can sort of see the generals of the game. All right, so that's number 10. Number 9, again, I don't think anyone's going to disagree with me on this, is the Wii U.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Nintendo's most prominent commercial miss, because a lot of people don't even remember the Virtual Boy is a thing.
Yeah, and, like, the Virtual Boy was never like, oh, this could, like, signal the end of them making these kinds of, like, home consoles. Like, that was never a conversation with that one.
Yeah, you know, it would sadden me for the Wii U to be remembered only as a miss, because I think there's some offbeat classics, and there are some things I like about it. I like that the Virtual Console brought some new things into the fray and whatnot. We talked about it last week. But, yeah, I mean, it missed. It's got the smallest library of first-party Nintendo games, or third-party, or any other party.
Yeah.
You know, it never got its own exclusive Zelda until now, sort of, but really that's a Switch game. You know, there were a lot of issues with it. It never really came to fruition. Their support for it always kind of felt half-hearted. They never, you know, I was seeing online the other day, like some of the early promotional materials for the Wii U, and I forgot that the gamepad and the way they pitched it originally was radically different.
Like, it was like as a weird accessory, like with like you can like draw like you draw a tablet kind of thing on it.
Sort of, but it's also it didn't have joysticks in the first version. It just had pads from the 3DS.
Oh yeah,
like it had a lot of different things. The gamepad was like a lot flatter, and the original ads showed a lot more integration between the gamepad and the screen than pretty much any game other than like Zombie U ever used. So that's all like clearly something in the development of that system. They pulled the brakes on something at some point and it came out feeling very half-baked. And now it feels like the Switch is what that always wanted to be, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I like a lot of things about the Wii U. Clearly, I don't think you could put it any higher than this, right?
I wouldn't.
Yeah. So, okay. The next Wii U. One. Here was the by far the hardest console for me to place, and this might be controversial, but just hear me out.
Okay.
8 is the Nintendo 64.
Okay.
It's kind of low.
That I think that is probably totally acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before. The N64 at its heights has at least two of the greatest games ever made and two of the most influential games ever made. It also had problems. It's got a shitty controller. It's got a fairly small library of actual upper-tier titles.
Yeah.
Like, debate if you want to include GoldenEye. It's still a small inner circle, I think. And there are a lot of things I love on the N64, but very few games I would sort of put in an upper echelon. And I'm not saying every console has to have a lot of those, but every other Nintendo console does have a lot of those.
Yeah, no, and I think even if you, like whatever, like, give people their fucking GoldenEye game, like, even if you had to include that, people only ever talk about playing, like, 5 fucking games on the N64, and, like, that's it. It's ridiculous. Like, you don't hear about other consoles. Like, nobody talks about the PlayStation 1 library and, like, says, like, all the only games you've ever heard about are Final Fantasy VII and Metal Gear Solid. Like, you hear about those a lot because they're really famous. But, like, it's a ridiculous, massive library of games. And in the 64, it's like, you've got, like, Mario, you've got Zelda, you've got, like, Banjo-Kazooie, and you've got the fucking GoldenEye, and you're like, Pokemon Snap. It's like, there you go. Paper Mario. Those are all the games that anyone has ever played on the N64. Those games are there, like, a handful of sequels.
Yeah. So, look, N64, super important console. I love, Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time. But I'll tell you this. If I want to play Ocarina of Time or Mario 64, the last place I want to play them is on the N64. Whereas, if you handed me a Super NES and Link to the Past or Super Metroid, absolutely I'll play them that way. It's great. But if you did that, like, with the N64 and Mario, I'd be like, can I just, like, emulate it on the Wii U or something? Like,
yeah.
Or can I play Ocarina of Time on its 3DS remake? Just please don't make me use the N64 controller.
Yeah. Because that's also the console where it... I mean, that I think it's one of the other ways you can really argue that it is that low is that it's the console where it was clear that Nintendo is not the lead platform in the market anymore. Like, that's where Sony took over. Like coming in out of nowhere from a business deal with Nintendo and taking over the largest market share. And, like, that's where Nintendo misread where so many things were going, like CDs and stuff like that. And just... it is a console that has some really amazing games, but except for maybe the Virtual Boy, every Nintendo console has some really amazing games, but a lot of other Nintendo consoles also didn't like misread where the industry was going the way the N64 did.
Yeah. All right, so let's move on to number 7 is the GameCube.
Okay.
Overall, I've always thought of this as like a better all-around console than the N64. Doesn't necessarily reach that console's high points. Although you've got things like Metroid Prime and Melee and Resident Evil 4 that have left a pretty damn enormous footprint on the gaming landscape.
Yeah.
But the GameCube had a much broader base of games than the N64 ever did.
Yeah.
Had a much better controller, was this cool little, just wonderful, quirky little cube, and it has the greatest startup animation ever.
Yes.
There's a lot I love.
It's got a handle.
Yep. The GameCube was my primary gaming device in childhood for... or at least home console, not like a portable thing, for many years, and I love it. I think the game library is where we're still kind of ranking these by, because I don't know if the GameCube has quite as many classics as the next 6 I'm going to put on this list, but it had some great games.
Yeah, for definitely. Sure. Wind Waker is very good.
Good, solid console, and, people love them, their fucking GameCube controller, and I don't necessarily agree, but I understand it, because it's a good gamepad, and at its best... yes, you want to play Melee that way.
There is no other controller anyone could play Super Smash Bros. With. Like, it just doesn't work. Like, that can... And to be fair, there's not a lot of other games anyone would ever really want to play only on the GameCube controller. If it's like Melee, it's like... a normal right analog stick would be terrible for the smash attacks. The C stick is just shitty enough and like fucking like unresponsive enough that you just slap that thing in whatever direction you go without a care. And it's like, there you go. That's how you get your smash attack out. With the normal right analog stick, it would be untenable. But like, you know, that's how the C stick worked. And that's the only good thing the C stick ever did for anybody.
Yep. All right. Number six is the Wii, the original Wii. Okay. The Wii is a hard one to place, but, you know, I think just on game library, if you were just going there, I still think it's above the last couple ones. You know, the Wii has a lot of classics on it. I just think for Mario Galaxy 1 and 2, you know, depending on where you are with Zelda games like Twilight Princess and Skyward Sword, there's enough people who would, you know, talk about those. There's Metroid Prime 3 and then the Metroid Prime Trilogy, where that to me is very much the best way to play Metroid Prime. Yeah. Is on that version. I don't like the GameCube versions of those as much. You know, lots of good Wii games, lots of good more casual games. I think Wii Sports is a lot of fun. I think they have other ones like that. And I like the Wiimote. I like the Wiimote, and I like playing with the Nunchuck, and I think it's an interesting design, and I think over time you saw the limitations of it. But I think it was a really interesting way to do things. And if you're talking about innovation and stuff, they really swung far with the Wii, and not every gamble they made with it paid off, but a lot of them clearly did, and I think it was an interesting thing to do. You know, one of the biggest flaws with the Wii U was tying themselves that clearly into it and not trying something new again, or at least, you know, they had to go in a different direction and they kind of went in no direction, which is weird. But at least for its time, the Wii was very successful. And I think one other thing to remember about the Wii is that for the time, it had a super sleek design. Yeah. It was really easy to, like, you know, hook up and play. And it was their first online machine, and at the time, it did that well, I think. Not necessarily...
I mean, contemporary with the Xbox 360, I would maybe disagree with you. Like
for some of their things.
Yeah.
I just think, like, you know, for a lot of people, though, that was, like, their first view of, like, buying online games and some of that stuff.
Sure.
And I think the problem is that Nintendo never, within the Wii generation or after that, seemed to advance past that point. But at first, it was kind of impressive, and I do remember playing some games online, like Mario Kart, and it worked really well at the time. Again, I wish they would improve on some of those things at this point. And right, I mean, Xbox Live left a lot of people in the dust in that generation, it's a hard standard to live up to. But, you know, like, it was their first machine that did things like Virtual Console, and it had all that GameCube integration, which was great, because you could have, you know, like, the next Smash Bros. Game, and just plug a GameCube controller in, and that's how everyone played it, and that's how everyone knew to play it.
Yeah.
And I think the level of backwards compatibility that we had, I always loved the audacity of it, just literally had a GameCube inside it. And
they resold you a GameCube that also had a sensor bar attached to it.
Yeah, and you just opened up the top, and it had all four controller ports, the memory card slots. The only thing it couldn't do that the GameCube could do was the Game Boy Player. Other than that, it was 100% backwards compatibility, and I've never seen anything quite like that.
Because they just sold you a GameCube. I mean, like, because also that thing, like, in terms of its power, it is literally a GameCube.
Right.
Like, it's that's like the one thing with the Wii that, like, is what made it successful in some ways, because it was so much cheaper than everything else on the market, and so it was like, you know, combined with the sort of accessibility of Wii Sports, it was like easy to get. But then also it makes it, I think, one of their, kind of like with the N64, it's kind of a hard console for me to go back to, or like even like at the time it felt like I was going back to the Wii, because it's like, holy shit, does text look fucking terrible in standard definition and stuff like that. There's like, things about that console that were very frustrating at the time. But I will say that there's something really interesting going on with kind of going back to the virtual reality stuff, that like you see echoes of what the Wii did with motion controls are like, that is where that has gone, where like, you know, Kinect and stuff that kind of failed, but it, like, the motion stuff has gone over to where like virtual reality is, and is like becoming very successful, and is clearly, if like anyone who knows anything about virtual reality, like that is how you need to do that. Like, you need to have those kinds of motion controls combined with the headset, and I think that's really fascinating that
And I've always
said, the work that Nintendo has pioneered, like, lives on. It lives on in a place that Nintendo isn't, like, working in anymore. But, like, it has had, like, a very sustained impact. Just that it moved to a different area than I think anyone was expecting.
I agree. I mean, I think a lot of, you know, for a period, people, I think, were saying that, like, the Wii had no lasting impact because the Kinect and the PlayStation Move just fell so flat, even though the Kinect sold a lot at first. But I've always maintained, I don't think the Kinect or the PlayStation Move stuff understood what was the appeal of the Wii at all. They just thought it was the gimmicky motion controls, and I think the Wii was a lot more than that, including that Nintendo was willing and able to make actual deep gameplay experiences with those things, and they never even really attempted that with the Kinect or the Move. So, yeah. You know, yeah, I think it is interesting that, you know, obviously the idea of the stick controller in your hand that you control with, absolutely that's where VR is going, you know?
Yeah. And I just love that Nintendo's lasting contribution to virtual reality video gaming has nothing to do with the console called the Virtual Boy.
It's very true, yeah. Yeah, so interesting. All right, number five is the Game Boy Advance.
Okay, yeah.
And I'm going to talk about later, like, why I can not separate the DS and the 3DS. To me, I can separate the Game Boy Color and the Game Boy Advance very easily, because Game Boy Advance games are such a kind of quantum leap from Game Boy and Game Boy Color games. Like, they just, you know, they feel very different in so many ways.
I mean, they have a different fucking aspect ratio, for God's sake.
Right, yeah, and, you know, just a different color depth and all these other things. But, you know, so while the Game Boy Advance is obviously tied very clearly into the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color, because it was 100% backwards compatible with all those things, I can separate it, and part of that is that this was a great system, and I'll talk about the games in a second. Great game lineup. But it also led to one of the smartest and most innovative designs in Nintendo history, the Game Boy Advance SP.
Yes.
Without the SP, we would never have the Nintendo DS, and that is Nintendo's biggest success story ever. You know, just, period. That's just, there's no way to say against that, especially if you add in, like, 3DS sales and stuff like that. That line over history has sold over 200 million units, you know, stuff like that. And the Game Boy Advance SP was just a genius, awesome design. And, you know, I think if you look at the Game Boy, and I even think the basic Game Boy Advance design, while it lacked a backlight, was still a pretty cool thing. The SP was much better. But, like, there was a level of sleekness to that, and then you go into, like, the DS and the DS Lite, where Nintendo was getting, I think you can trace a lot of the sleekness in their modern handhelds, and certainly the Switch belongs to that kind of legacy of sleekness, more than some of their home consoles, that comes from the Game Boy Advance era, and that they did a lot of cool stuff with that. And the Advance had, you know, cool peripherals, like the link cables and some of the four-player stuff you would do with that, and then eventually you got into some of the games that used, like, the wireless technology and stuff. It was neat. But, again, the games lineup is number one for me, and, you know, this is where Fire Emblem was born for us in the West. This is where you had things like Metroid Fusion and Metroid Zero Mission and the Wario Land 4.
Yes,
and,
Wario Land 4 is so good.
Sonic Advance and some of those, the Pokemon games for the GBA. You don't like them, I like them, Ruby and Sapphire, I mean, whatever.
They're fine. They're not terrible.
Yeah, I wouldn't put them with that upper tier that I was just ranking, but there's a bunch of those. There were a bunch of great RPGs and JRPGs. And it, to me, like, most memorably, had this wide host of ports from the NES and Super NES days that I think introduced a huge generation of people to those games again.
Yeah.
Because this was before anything like Virtual Console. You couldn't do that at the time, but you could play Link to the Past, and there was the Super Mario Advance series. And for a lot of us who didn't, you know, weren't there for the Super NES era, that's where we were introduced to these games. And that was awesome, because on the Game Boy Advance, they weren't diminished experiences, because it basically had the capabilities of a Super NES. And in some cases, they're the best versions of those games.
Yeah, like, I think that's still, like, the best version of Final Fantasy 1 is on the Game Boy Advance.
Absolutely. And, all the Final Fantasy ports they did were fantastic.
Yeah.
And then the Mario games. Like, that's my favorite version of Mario 3, hands down. And probably Mario 2, although that's a harder one to gauge. But just things like that, you know. It had Mario World on it. It had all these great. That's where I played Yoshi's Island. That's, you know, even though those are not, like, exclusives to the GBA, that it had these great exclusives, and then also allowed people, like, of our age to discover all these classics was a really special thing.
And that, like sort of discovering that a lot of those games work so well portably, like Final Fantasy, like those early Final Fantasy games. I think of them as being portable games because that's how I played them, and, like, that's the format I feel like they work best in. There's something because you're able to sort of get into them and play a little bit and then back out because they're not as, like, heavy and dense on story stuff. It's like, that works so well. Like, Link to the Past works so well as a portable game, you know?
Yeah. So my number four slot is the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color combined.
Sure.
I think that's fair. Like, most color games you could play on a regular Game Boy even. So, you know, they were kind of very, very closely linked. And while I have more personal nostalgia for the Game Boy Advance, this is a point where, like, if I'm trying to make some kind of an objective ranking in some way, like, the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color, clearly, like, if we go back to my 10% that is, like, or 15% that's innovation and influence, it doesn't get much more innovative and influential than the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color. And, you know, you just think of things like, That's the system that introduced the world to Tetris. Something like that. And that's where Pokemon comes from. And that's where, you know, Nintendo proved that they could make deep experiences on the go, like a Link's Awakening, or like a Mario Land, or Mario Land 2, or maybe my favorite Game Boy game, Wario Land 1, which is just incredible, and things like that. You know, I have, the Game Boy Color was the first gaming system I ever owned, myself, you know, personally, that I got to play, and I played that thing to death, and then when I got my Game Boy Advance, I just kept playing it to death, but, or those games to death, but on a different system, and, you know, I love the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color. They have so many great games. Even though, like, the earliest Game Boy games are sort of a little before my time,
yeah,
the Game Boy was around so long that even if you came in on, like, the Game Boy Color, chances are you played a lot of older Game Boy games because they were just part of the library, and that library is enormous. And while there's certainly plenty of games on the Game Boy that, you know, have not aged well, it's surprising how many don't feel like they've aged a day. You know?
Yeah, no. And I mean, I think it's something else you can say about Game Boy going, like, to the business side of things, is that, like, obviously, like, in the DS and 3DS era, Sony has had their PSP and Vita also in the handheld market, but, like, there was, Nintendo had no, like, literally no competition in the handheld market, unless you count, like, the N-Gage for the Game Boy Advance era, but they did in the Game Boy, in Game Boy Color era, and there's a reason why no competitors showed back up the second time around, because they got fucking so beat down by Nintendo in the Game Boy. Like, was so head and shoulders above any other portable console for, like, a decade, basically. You know, like, anything like the Atari Lynx and the Game Gear. Like, nothing could make a foothold in that market so hard that nobody even tried when the Advance came around.
Yeah. It's incredible. I mean, Nintendo has made so few missteps with their portable consoles.
Yeah.
It is pretty incredible. You know, I had I had a very tough time deciding between 2 and 1, and it was between a portable and a home, and you'll see what I'm going for there. But yeah, the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color, pretty fantastic devices.
I really like Dragon Ball Z Legendary Super Warriors on the Game Boy Color. I played that game a lot.
That's a good one. I played more Dragon Ball games on the Game Boy Advance, because Legacy of Goku 2, great Dragon
Very
Ball
good,
game.
Yes.
Boost for Fury, sure. Almost as good, not quite, but still really good.
Yeah, I think I told this story on the podcast, but I found out how Dragon Ball Z ended by playing Legendary Super Warriors, because that game came out before the Boo arc ended in Toonami over here.
Yeah.
So that I'll always remember that game because of that.
Yep, nice.
I also always remember that game because the localization was amazingly bad, and they could never, like, I think there must have been something where they could not translate something as, like, he killed this person, or, like, that person died. So it's like, oh no, Frieza defeated Krillin! And it's like, Frieza did a bit more than defeat Krillin.
Yeah.
Dude fucking blew up. I watched the show. I know what happened.
Number 3 is the NES, the Nintendo Entertainment System. This is a really hard one to know where to place today.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I do find NES games can be pretty hard to go back to generally for me.
Some of them can be, and some of them can be really hard to go back to. Some of them are easy as anything to go back to. I can always play some Super Mario Bros. Or some Mario 3 or things like that. And you're right. I mean, some of them are harder. But in some sense, it is Nintendo's most important console. You could make that argument because it revived console gaming from the ashes of this giant crash and set the stage for the entire industry we have today. And that is a, you know, piece of gaming history that is just incredible. And you have to be able to, you know, put that historical lens on and see it through that. And, you know, this is also where, even if some of the original ones are hard to go back to, this is where all the Nintendo franchises were birthed.
Yeah.
You got Metroid and Zelda and Mario born here. And some others were born during the SNES and stuff. But the NES, you know, that library, at least in terms of historical impact, if not always in terms of what holds up for, like, modern gamers, it's incredible. And, you know, really at its best, there's nothing quite like great 8-bit graphics and music, just in terms of certain simple charm and some of that stuff. Like, I can always go just listen to the fucking soundtrack to Castlevania and be like, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that on anything else. That's awesome. So NES, the system I obviously have, like, the least experience with.
Yeah, me too.
But again, if I'm trying to do some kind of objective ranking, there are certain NES games I've played many times and love, like original Mario Bros. Or something. And yeah, I feel like with the different things I was saying earlier, it clearly holds a place high in the Nintendo pantheon. And in the video game history pantheon.
Yeah,
has
sure.
to. All right, number 2 is the DS and 3DS line.
I think we all know what number 1 is then.
Yeah. And here's the thing. This is like the one gimmick from Nintendo's 2000 streak that to me unequivocally, absolutely worked and settled quickly into a natural, organic part of this console that could be used heavily or lightly in games, but always added to the experience. And allowed Nintendo to create that beautiful clamshell design that has done so much to make this the handheld console of choice since 2004.
Yeah.
And why I cannot personally separate the DS and the 3DS, even though they are technically separate consoles,
They're not technically separate consoles. They are two fucking... They are different consoles. They are as different consoles as the PlayStation 1 and PlayStation 2 are different consoles.
Sure, but the thing for me is, I have had a DS, like, with me at all times for 12 years. Like, it has been my constant gaming companion. And yes, things have evolved over time, but if I think, you know, I've swapped them out. So I had an original DS, then I had a DS Lite, never got the DSi because that thing was stupid. But then, you know, after the DS Lite, I got up to my 3DS, my 3DS XL, my new 3DS XL. And to me, it's a continuum. It's this continuity where...
Of course, they're all a continuum. Like, the Game Boy is on that continuum.
But that's...
Jonathan, they're different consoles. You can put them in the same... I just want you to say, not technically... The Nintendo DS and the Nintendo 3DS are two distinct systems that are two very distinct hardware platforms.
They're distinct hardware platforms, is true, but I cannot in any way separate them emotionally or in my head.
Okay.
Because I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you say, like, you can kind of technically separate, like, the DS library and the 3DS library, but because they are such similar consoles, like, the 3DS has, you know, better graphics and it's got the 3D and the different aspect ratio on the top screen, but... You know, a lot of the menu was very similar, and it's all got all the same controls plus some extras on the 3DS. And a lot of, you know, franchises that started and were birthed on the DS just continued on their merry way on the 3DS.
You are not saying anything that is distinguishing them from any other, like, two platforms that are right next to each other. They are all like that, Josh. They all do that. That's how video game consoles evolve and go on to the next stage.
But there's a difference with something like the PlayStation that is something you hook into your TV and it's just a traditional console versus something like for Nintendo, the dual screen sort of thing that has a very unique design that those are not games that run on anything else. I think there's something very unique about the DS and the experience it gives, and it just feels like, to me, much more of a solid continuum than, you know, the PlayStation 1 into the PlayStation 2, per your example. And certainly more than most modern consoles. There's no continuity from, like, the PS2 to the PS3 on a lot of those levels because it wasn't backwards compatible and those sorts of things.
Well,
at the beginning.
And the Xbox 360 in, like, a weird way, but the Xbox 360 was technically backwards compatible.
Sure. But, I don't know, when I think of, you know, I'm trying to think of another example. Like, I don't think of the Wii to the Wii U the same way. In
sure,
part because they control differently and they run differently, and I don't think of even the Game Boy Color to the Game Boy Advance, because it's, you know, you pick up the Game Boy Advance and it's a radically different design. If you went from your DS Lite to a 3DS, it didn't feel like you were stepping into a different generation in that same way, because you opened it the same and you held it the same and all those things, and that to me does feel different than a lot of other controllers.
Okay.
The PS1 to the PS2 I see because they use literally the same controller.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of examples like that.
With the exception of the 6-axis, they use the same controller for the PS3 as well.
Sure. But...
Yes.
Anyway.
I'm just saying it's a very strange distinction to make.
Okay, as the person who doesn't own a 3DS, back off for a minute.
Okay.
You can't actually talk about this with the same expertise I have. So,
I
don't know what
like
your thing
most,
is.
I feel like most people would recognize that the DS and the 3DS are very different consoles.
They're
like,
not very different consoles.
As different as the Game Boy to Game Boy Advance are.
No, I just said why I don't think that's the case.
Because both of them have two screens. Both the Game Boy and Game Boy Advance have one screen.
But they're... Okay, the game... But there's thing again, like I said, about the way you hold them or something like that. Like the Game Boy Color and the Game Boy, you know, same design where it's like this straight block, right? And then you go to the Game Boy Advance, which has that side block, or the SP, which is a foldable thing. That just, and the, you know, the cartridge sticks out differently on those. Like if you put a Game Boy Color cartridge.
Their hardware design is similar on like the physical thing.
They play the same. If you put a
Just continue.
Whatever. This is the stupidest fucking argument you've ever gotten me in.
Because I just don't see how you could justify putting them as the same thing on the list. It just doesn't make sense.
How would you separate them, Sean? Where would you rank them?
As someone who has never played... never played a 3DS, but I've never owned a 3DS. I would put the DS above them, although I never really played my DS much either.
There, yeah. Your expertise shines through on that.
Well, I don't see how I need to have some sort of masterful expertise of the DS and 3DS platforms to recognize that they are two distinct hardware systems. That like
I said they're two distinct hardware systems,
distinct
but that I have
to be
to,
on different places.
I have no idea at all, and I think most people who own this console, I want to hear comments on this.
Okay.
On Twitter, on the site, I want to hear. How would you actually separate those if you were trying to rank these two systems? I don't think it's possible in terms of just saying the continuum of Nintendo handheld designs in the 2000s. It's the same way the Game Boy and the Game Boy Color to me I can't separate.
Okay.
And I feel like if I threw the Game Boy Advance as a third thing in there, that would be like a bridge too many. This is Game Boy to Game Boy Color territory.
Okay.
The color being added being 3D.
Okay.
Other than that, they're very similar systems. And you trade one up for the next and you're not losing anything. That sort of thing is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Now, what I was trying to say there is that the games library throughout this run, other than like the break in the first year of the 3DS, which was really rocky, has been just so incredible over time, and maybe the 3DS at one point even one-upping what the DS had, because the DS was very much kind of in that Game Boy Advance zone of having a good number of exclusives, but also relied a lot on ports and things like that, which was awesome because you got to see some of those games for the first time again. The 3DS has had a little bit of that with like Ocarina of Time 3D and Majora's Mask 3D,
yeah.
But otherwise mostly originals and just an incredible streak of originals, you know, Fire Emblem coming back into prominence in the 3DS era. And it's just, you know, 12 years going on that this has been like my go-to gaming device in some ways. I would say unequivocally, like, of still supported consoles I play, what is my favorite? It's the 3DS. It's the one I, you know, go back to in maybe not the most these days, because the PS4 has gotten to a point where it's very well supported, obviously, and that's my go-to home console. But if I had to go to a desert island with one system, it would be the 3DS. I've had just things like the other way, you know, reasons I can't separate it, like the carrying case I have had. I've had the same carrying case for 12 years that I had all my DSs in, and then my 3DS. I had to do a small alteration when the XL came out, because I had never, and I would have had to do that if I got like a DS XL, but I never got one of those. So I did like a small alteration to it, but I've kept them in the same like fucking case for 12 years. There's like no other console I can quite think of that feels that closely tied together in that same kind of sense. And so for me, these go together, and it's my favorite thing Nintendo's ever done on some level. There is one console that I feel like needs to be Nintendo's number one under any circumstances, but I think you could very much make the argument that the DS and the 3DS is the best and most important thing Nintendo's done, especially if you look at just how, you know, well that has held up over these 12 years. And even if, again, separate their sales, sure, 150 million for the Nintendo DS and 65 million going on strong for the 3DS, even though that's less for the 3DS, for the era we're in, that's amazing that that's continued that way. So
yeah,
that's my call on that.
Okay. I've looked forward to us ranking all of the Sony handheld systems and it being the PSP and the Vita as number one.
There are only two
handheld systems. That's, I was making a joke, okay. Because like the PSP and the Vita are both like very, you hold them in the same way and they have very similar design like looks.
Sure.
So they're counted as the same entry on the list.
Sure. I mean, that might be a little harder with that just because there are only two, so I don't know. But yeah, that's never used an original PSP.
It was not very good.
Yeah.
I never bought one.
People liked it in its day. There were a lot of hipsters who loved the PSP.
Like, I'm sure it had a lot of good games, especially for like you were playing in Japan, but it was just like the fucking, I could never get past the circle pad thing on the PSP. Like, I could just never do it.
The nub,
it just like always felt like the worst thing in the world. It made me just like physically
cringe
manipulating it.
That's one place where I can think of the Vita as more separate than the DS and the 3DS, is the DS wasn't like deficient in some design way where the 3DS had to come in and really improve on that to make it palatable to people who didn't like the DS.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, yeah, the Vita is like such a clear step up over what they did with the PSP in terms of design and power and all that. Yeah, but I see what you're saying.
Okay.
All right. Number one is the Super NES.
Oh, really? Wow. Ah,
yeah.
I thought it was going to be the GameCube, but no, that's right. We already had that one down there.
Of course, I mean, there's no other option, right?
Yeah, that's what I would do as well.
I mean, I don't think there ever will be. And that's not to say that I think Nintendo is going to fail in the near future. I just don't see... I think if you go purely on the strength of game library, which is what I was talking about earlier, the Super NES is, to me, without peer in the history of gaming, not just Nintendo. Like, the closest you could probably come... We talked about this off the air last week. Is, like, maybe, like, the PlayStation 1... If you look at like the sheer breadth of games that were made for that.
Yeah, just the ridiculous number of games.
Yeah. But like the Super NES, just, you could list mind-boggling game changers that were released on the SNES just all day long.
Uh-huh.
You could, you know, say, I'm only going to play SNES games for the next 2 years, and you would never run out of like great things to play. You know, if you look at like the Mario Worlds and the Super Metroids and A Link to the Past and the Final Fantasies and Chrono Trigger and Donkey Kong Country, and that's just like the uppermost sphere. And then you can go deeper and deeper and deeper, yeah. And there's so many other things.
Yeah, it has such a dense library that's like there are no, I don't know, like NES classics that like nobody has ever heard of because like libraries, like it's big, but it's not unfathomably big, and I feel like everyone kind of knows that. Like, I feel like you will hear about SNES games that like you've never heard about in your life, and it's like, oh, there's like this whole community that loves this game to death. I didn't even know, I've never even heard this game's name before, in the same way you can with like the PlayStation 1.
Yeah, I hear that pretty frequently actually when I go look at like top SNES lists and stuff. And I think I've made a pretty good dent in the last few years of catching up on SNES games, but I've still got ones that I've never been able to get the time to like fully play through, like a Final Fantasy VI or something like that. But it's incredible. Like, even the titles that survive more as, like, historical artifacts, which I would call, like, Star Fox, Super Mario Kart, those are fascinating historical artifacts. And I think they're still invigorating to play from that, like, academic level of, like, evidence of a great leap in gaming history. Of, like, this was a stepping stone more than a finished product, but it's a fascinating stepping stone.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the SNES in that era, and I think we talked about this a little bit 2 weeks ago, it's like the end of the silent film era in cinema, where there was this sort of height of artistry up to that moment, and then cinema changed, you know, very drastically with the advent of sound, and it took a while to get back to that level. Some might argue we never have gotten back to that level, or we haven't reached the culmination of what that is. And I would say the same thing here, like, the era of 3D gaming, whatever we call the era we're in, from the N64 and the PlayStation onwards, so many great experiences, and so much that, you know, you could never have done in the past, but we're still not at whatever the culmination of that is. Whereas you can look at the SNES as the culmination of a time and place in gaming history, and some of those, you know, the best games there will literally never age.
Yeah.
They will always be playable, and, you know, the SNES also, like, if I look at those other things, it's not as innovative as some of the other Nintendo consoles. You know, it's a pretty basic thing. It's a gamepad, and that gamepad is very innovative in terms of popularizing, like, shoulder buttons and stuff like that, and the basic four-button design every controller uses now. But those are more sort of, like, basic quality-of-life things versus, you know, the NES inventing home console gaming for this, like, period and things like that. Or the Wii reinventing motion controls and things. Or the DS having the two screens. The SNES didn't have, like, gimmicks like that. It was just a super fucking solid console. And even if you don't own one, you have to be a Super NES fan if you're a fan of games, sort of, you know?
Yeah, even if you did not play it on a Super Nintendo, like, there are a lot of Super Nintendo games that, like, you could have played in other places, like a Game Boy Advance, or they're like PlayStation 1 ports of a lot of those games, like Chrono Trigger and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. No, I mean, and also, like, just Super Nintendo was Nintendo on top of the world, you know, they had the largest market share, and that was, I mean, that is, when you really think about it in some ways, that is the last time Nintendo had, like, really, really strong third-party support for their console. Like, there were a lot of third-party games made for the Wii, just not a lot of good ones. Like, the Super Nintendo was where it was, like, third parties were, like Squaresoft at the time, making Final Fantasy, like, making incredible games for the Super Nintendo, like, not owned by Nintendo, just making it for that platform. And it's like, it's one of those things that it's weird to think about how, when you look at the history of it, just how long Nintendo has not been on that. Like, how long Nintendo platforms have just been platforms that you buy for Nintendo-made games. And it's like, it used to be in a very different market. Like, nope, like, everybody made games on a Nintendo platform, because if you didn't, you would be making, like, PC games or something.
Yeah. So, you know, the conclusions from my list, and I tried to do it kind of, because again, if I were to say, like, my favorite Nintendo consoles, I go the DS legacy, however you want to phrase that, because yes, you are correct, Sean. They're two separate consoles. I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings.
I just think, for the sake of science, we should be accurate about these things. Okay. And I feel like you maybe weren't.
Okay, I understand. Maybe I would put them at number 1 and 2 in some order. But those are, like, my favorite Nintendo consoles. But I do think, in terms of, like, the game library, the influence, all those things, Super NES is kind of uncontested number one. But the other thing I've been thinking about is that, you know, I totally think you have to rank at, like, number 1 and 2 for Nintendo. One has to be a portable, one has to be a home console.
Yeah, it's been the two wings of their business for so long.
And it's why, while Nintendo has a lot to prove with the Switch, and you cannot say at this juncture whether it will be a huge success or a huge failure, any of that, it does seem like the best possible move Nintendo could make right now is to combine those two legacies.
Yeah.
And I think it seems like, at least as a start for that, they've got a really, really solid platform in which to do that. Again, they've got a lot left to prove with it, and I'm super excited to start taking that journey next week, but it seems like it could be a really bright era for Nintendo going forward, if they play their cards right.
Yeah. It's hard to tell. But yeah, I'm really excited to see what they do. For yeah. sure, like whatever, you know, for whatever else, like that Zelda game seems like it's going to be real good.
Real good, you know, we've got a new Mario coming by the end of the year, so yeah. hey, within year one, they're going to be better off than the Wii U was in year five. So yeah. that, at least, they will have overcome that hurdle. Then they got another couple hurdles to overcome, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Now all we have to do is discover, like, just piece together the greatest mystery in video game history, Jonathan Lack. Which is better, the Nintendo DS or the Nintendo 3DS? You have to do this just 3D, for me.
3DS.
The 3DS is better.
Yeah.
So it goes Super Nintendo, Nintendo 3DS, Nintendo DS.
I can do that for you if you want. Yes.
I don't see why that was so hard.
Okay. I don't know. It's just because, again, I think I was able to explain why to me they feel like a combined thing.
Sure.
But no, I would put 3DS up there because it builds on the DS. It's a better version of what that did. You can still play all your DS games on it. And I actually think the peaks of the 3DS library are better than the peaks of the DS library.
Okay.
So, that's why.
That should have just been the list in the first place.
It's just, you can come, you know, you combine them and it's easy. Okay, preview of next week. Okay. Next week's show. We're going to have to go see Logan. Talk about Logan.
Yes,
holy shit, that movie looks good.
It looks really good, yeah. Very
excited for it. And I'm going to have the Switch. I'm going to try to, you know, I'll only have had it for a couple of days. Maybe, I don't know if I'll be able to record next Sunday. We might record a little, it might come out a little later in the week. We'll figure it out off the air. But the next episode will have first impressions of the Switch / Zelda Breath of the Wild. Yes,
I will have played Horizon Zero Dawn.
You'll have played Horizon Zero Dawn. And we'll have both seen Logan, so that sounds like it'll be an insane episode. But yeah. We'll do what we can with it. All right.
All right, then. And then we're going to have to, like, make 100% sure we're going to have to redo this list, Jonathan, from top to bottom. You have to rewrite it.
Okay, do you want me to really quickly redo it? Like,
yes, just run it down for me. Number 11.
Number 11 is the Virtual Boy.
Yes.
I closed the fucking list. Off the top of my head, number 10 then was the Wii U.
Yes.
Number 9 was the Nintendo 64.
Uh-huh.
8 is the GameCube.
Yes.
7 is the Wii. Yep. 5 is the Game Boy Advance.
You skipped 6.
Sorry, 6 is the Game Boy Advance. Yep. Since you're being, you know what? Since you're being such a stickler, we're going to go to 12.
Okay.
I'm going to restart. Okay. 12 is the Virtual Boy.
Yeah.
11 is the Wii U.
Yep.
That's 10 is the Nintendo 64.
Uh-huh.
9 is the GameCube. Is that where we're at? Yeah,
yes,
9
yes,
is the GameCube.
9.
8 is the Wii.
It is the Wii.
7 is the Game Boy Advance.
Yes.
6 is the Game Boy Color.
Okay.
5 is the Game Boy.
Okay.
4 is the NES.
All right.
3 is the Nintendo DS. 2 is the Nintendo 3DS. And 1 is the Super NES. Are you happy now? I split them
Thank
all out.
Thank you, Jonathan Lack. That is now the definitive list of the 12 Nintendo consoles. Now I need you to put every single game and watch console on it.
How many do you think there are of those?
I have no idea.
No clue.
We'll get cracking on that for next week.